You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I've got to beware.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Christopher Bolin. Today's show, Architects of Terror. Christopher Bolin is an independent researcher, investigative journalist, and author. Upon graduation from high school in Cook County, Illinois, he spent the next 3 years traveling extensively throughout Europe and the Middle East, finally settling in both a kibbutz in Israel and in Norway, where he studied Egyptian, Biblical Hebrew, and Norwegian at the University of Oslo. He is a graduate of the University of California in history with an emphasis on Israel-Palestine. Along with research and writing, he has worked as an editor and translator. His travels and studies of German, Spanish, Norwegian, Swedish, Hebrew, and Arabic languages have helped him analyze international politics and events. He is the author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and Solving 9/11, The Articles. Christopher Bolin, welcome again.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
In Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, you have a chapter entitled The Architecture of Terror, Mapping the Network Behind 9/11. This chapter includes a dizzying array of connected companies and people, both in and out of government, that were in positions to facilitate and orchestrate the events of September 11th. You met with Andreas von Bülow, the former head of the parliamentary commission that oversaw the financing of the German intelligence agencies. What did von Bülow have to say about what he termed as a, quote, sophisticated false flag operation like 9/11?
Well, the first thing he told me was this was in November or early December 2001 in Germany. He told me that first of all, he suspected that Israeli intelligence was behind the 9/11 atrocity. And then he said that such a sophisticated operation, a false flag operation, would involve three different levels. The first level, he said, was the architectural level. This is the people who planned the false flag crime in order to have it blamed on a third party. In this case, you know, the Arab Muslims, fanatics of Osama bin Laden. And the purpose of their false flag terrorism is to basically change public opinion. In this case, change U.S. public opinion to support the war agenda in the Middle East and to support the increased defense spending. The second level, he said, was the managerial level. These are the people who managed the setting up of the crime and then managed the deception that follows the crime. And they also, this managerial level, control the third level, which is the working level. And, for example, he said the working level is part of the deception. In this case, the working level would be, for example, the 19 Arabs, the alleged hijackers.
Did von Bülow have anything else to say about his opinion of this operation?
Yes, well, it was surprising that he said, quite frankly, that he thought it was an Israeli operation, Israeli intelligence. And I went ahead and reported that in the report that I wrote up about our discussion. And he was surprised because he had said the same thing to German journalists. But as he said, that none of the German journalists would ever publish such a statement. But I did. And he was a little bit surprised at that, you know, our media or the paper I wrote for would go ahead and say such a thing.
You write that there is evidence of an Israeli intelligence network connecting every key player and entity behind 9/11. The people and companies and their interrelationships are quite complex. Can you talk about a few of these networks, the people and companies?
Yeah, well, there's a host of them. Ehud Barak, for example, when he lost the election to Ariel Sharon, came over to the United States in the late winter of 2000 and was working in the United States, you know, for the 10 months or so prior to 9/11. And he worked with a company that was actually produced aluminum nanoparticles, nanocomposites, which is one of the key elements of nanothermite. And then there was, as you said, in that Chapter 7, The Architecture of Terrorism, there's a whole host of companies, you know, including NICE and NICE, that's an Israeli company, and others. And as I found, as I demonstrate in this chapter, these Israeli companies are all interrelated, interlinked with, for example, the scores of Israeli art students who were spying on and trying to set their stuff up in DEA offices across this country. These companies and these relationships were actually investigated after I wrote the chapter by an English editor and a fact checker. And he examined 105 statements that I made in that chapter and found that all of them were correct. And this was a person in England who was actually hostile to my thesis that this was an Israeli operation. But he was hired by a publisher in Europe to check the facts of that chapter that you referred to, The Architecture of Terrorism, and found that all of my connections, all of my statements were in fact true.
Yes, that chapter is very complex. It was hard for me to hold it in my mind all at once because there's so many interconnections and a huge cast of characters. Now, you mentioned the art students. This is a very important point. You go into that in some detail in your book. What can you tell us about these art students? Who do we think they might have been?
Well, that's a really interesting. These art students were Israelis who pretended to be art students. And actually, though, I think it was the DEA had done a working paper, an analysis of these students who had been arrested and who had been caught, and found that they were actually Israeli military personnel, active, who had served in or were members of demolition units. Many of them, like there was a Per Segelowitz, I think his name was, who was one of the heads of this, one of the heads of these teams, and he had led a platoon or a group of like 80 other soldiers, and their specialty was in fact demolition. And these people were the ones who were, you know, found trying to infiltrate into DEA offices, Drug Enforcement Agency offices, and private homes of agents of the DEA across the United States. And this when this information came out, this was also part of the Carl Cameron four-part series on Fox News that came out just after 9/11. But there's a tie-in. These individuals in this Israeli art student spying operation were connected to Israeli companies that were, you know, also tied into 9/11. As you said, it's very complex. It's a what I've done is I've created a flow chart sort of thing where I have mapped out these entities and show the relationships between them. And what Israeli intelligence has done for a long time, actually, in this country, in the United States, is that they set up a company in Israel. The research and development of the company is done in Israel, and they create the headquarters or business office for that company in Menlo Park, California, or Silicon Valley, or Boston, or what have you. And so it has the appearances from the outside of being an American company when in fact it is an Israeli intelligence operation, 100%.
Now, you just said that these Israeli art students, so-called, at least some of them, were arrested. What were they arrested for?
Well, they were arrested and caught when they were very aggressively trying to get into or they're harassing DEA offices and DEA personnel at their private residences. And so the DEA document lists the names, sometimes the spelling isn't quite correct, of these agents as they were caught, as they were observed, trying to basically infiltrate DEA offices across the country. And this was going on in I think it was in Texas, in California, and a lot in Florida. Most of the activity was actually being done in Florida, right around the area where these 19 alleged hijackers lived.
Well, now, do you have any opinion as to why they would be trying to infiltrate the DEA? I mean, now, there is evidence that these 19 or how many ever accused hijackers that were living in Florida were actually dealing drugs. Isn't that right?
Well, that could very well be. And the thing is that what we also know about the alleged hijackers, the 19 Arab alleged hijackers, is that many of them had been issued duplicate licenses. And when you read the details, you find that, you know, for example, one of the Arab hijackers would get the license on a Wednesday. And the very next day, a call would come into the DMV, what have you, the people who issue licenses in Florida, requesting a duplicate license issued and with the excuse that the person had moved to a new residence and had a new address. So what you have is you have basically two IDs for the same person in circulation at the same time. And this is an indication that, and many of these people had also reported having lost their passports. So what this indicates is that there were two people going around with the same ID, leaving basically a false trail in the name of the person who was to be implicated in the crime. So that's a Mossad operation tactic that's been used for a long time, and it's very well described in the book by John Le Carré. He wrote a book in 1982 called The Little Drummer Girl, and it's about a similar Israeli terror operation in Europe. George Roy Hill made a film about it, but the book explains how this is done, how a false trail is left to implicate a person in a crime. And that's what we have. That's apparently what we had with these 19 alleged hijackers. Somebody was leaving a trail in their name to implicate them in the crime. And as you say, why would the Israelis be interested in infiltrating and getting into DEA offices? Probably because they were trying to do intelligence gathering on the DEA. And what I see is that the Clintons and the Bush families have been involved in this drug operation that began back in the 1980s, you know, between the Medellin cartel, and the Israelis were involved in this. So having access to the DEA offices and the information would give them the power, especially with this computer enterprise software, to know what is going on in the DEA at any given time in real time. That's what they probably wanted.
And how would that information have benefited them?
Well, the thing is that, as I point out in the chapter of the planes of 9/11, the second chapter of the book, Solving 9/11, the Israeli Aircraft Industries, IAI, has long had a base in Bogota, Colombia. And I believe, and I think the evidence is pretty clear, that the Israelis have been involved in this drug operation from Colombia to the United States, along with the Bush family and the Clinton family. And nothing ties people more closely together than a crime committed together. And I think that the crime here is this, that they basically took over the Medellin drug cartel operations. And this is, I think, why Philip Marshall was killed in Calaveras County a year or so ago, because he had written a book called Lakefront Airport. And he writes about his experiences. It's an autobiographical novel in which he writes about his experiences being the personal pilot, the Learjet pilot, for Barry Seal. And Barry Seal was, of course, the drug smuggler who turned to be a DEA informant. And this is the crime where these families are connected. The operation was being run out of the White House, out of the basement of the White House by Papa Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Bill Clinton was, of course, the governor in Arkansas when Barry Seal was flying all this massive amounts of cocaine into Arkansas. And what the problem is for them is that this pilot, Philip Marshall, knew the names, knew the places, knew the operation, and had written a book about it. And he was planning to write a fourth book, but the third book, Lakefront Airport, is very hard to get. Right now, if you want to buy it on Amazon, it costs about $600. But I just read it, and you can see very clearly that it's his inside knowledge of this drug operation, weapons and drug operation called, you know, the Iran-Contra thing, that's what put his life in danger, because he knew the names and he knew what was going on.
Wasn't his entire family killed?
Yeah, except for his divorced wife. He was living in Calaveras County. He had the two children, a boy and a girl. They were found shot on the couches in the front room. And his dog was shot, and he was found dead. And it was a very strange thing. The police in Calaveras County were very slow to respond. There was clearly an element to this crime that was, a cover-up. And I think Wayne Madsen wrote extensively about it. He went out to Calaveras County and visited the home and the site and some of the witnesses. But it certainly appears that this man, he also wrote a book called, False Flag 9/11 and The Big Bamboozle. But Philip Marshall's books about 9/11 do not put him in any sort of dangerous situation, because he basically supports the official version of 9/11. It's not those books. They're not the reason he was killed. The reason I think he was killed was because he had inside information, firsthand information about the drug smuggling operation that involved the Clintons, the Bushes, and the Israelis. That's why he was a danger to the system.
You mentioned the little drummer girl. You write that John le Carré's 1983 novel, The Little Drummer Girl, is about Israeli false flag operations, and that in the preface to his book, John le Carré thanked past and serving officers of Israeli intelligence. I believe The Little Drummer Girl was also made into a movie. Yes, you mentioned this.
Right.
What is the storyline of The Little Drummer Girl, and what do you think is its significance?
Yeah, John le Carré signed the foreword to that book, or the preface, in I think it was July 1982. And that's exactly the time when the Israelis were invading Lebanon in 1982 under Ariel Sharon and Menachem Begin. But as he says in the very beginning, he thanks and he names these people. He names the former head of Israeli military intelligence for basically, giving him all this information and insight about how Israeli intelligence operations work in Europe. And in this book, and in the movie, I think it's Diane Keaton plays the role. She's an actress from England, and she is basically recruited by the Mossad to help entrap a Palestinian. And she goes down to Turkey or Greece and hooks up with this Palestinian guy. And they have sort of a relationship, a romance. But the whole purpose of the book is to implicate this Palestinian in terrorism that he's not actually involved in. And in the movie, you know, some of the scenes in the movie involve like Israelis blowing up a synagogue, but it's not really they're not really blowing up the synagogue. They're putting charges in the window and blowing the windows out. It's all theatrics. And that's one of the key statements in the book by one of the Mossadniks. He says that terror is theater. Theater's a con trick. Do you know what that means? Con trick? You've been deceived. And that's very important, to understand how the Israeli military intelligence goes about implicating and setting up a crime like this so that the authorities that do the investigation following the crime come away believing and thinking and having in their hands evidence that implicates, Arabs or terrorists or whatever, Palestinians, when in fact the whole thing has been basically theater. And that's what we're seeing now and much more in the United States. We're seeing these incidents like, San Bernardino and Boston Marathon. We're seeing terrorist attacks or terrorist incidents where clearly the public can see that we're being deceived. It's really the theater aspect of these crimes, of these terrorist attacks, is becoming very evident. So it's like the game is up. These people are still doing these terrorist attacks. They're still doing them on a daily basis in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. But when they do these kinds of crimes in this country, the public has woken up to the fact that we are being deceived, and that's a really good thing.
There was ultimately an unsuccessful attempt to obtain the security contract for the New York Port Authority back in 1987. Mm-hmm. Who obtained the security contract, and how did they lose it?
Well, that's a very interesting aspect of this crime. A couple Mossadniks, these are high-level Mossad agents. Zvi Malkin is one of them, and the other one is Avram Shalom Ben-Dor. These two men were very high-level Mossad agents working under Yisr Harel, the first chief of the Mossad and the first chief of the Shin Bet, basically. This is Israeli domestic intelligence and foreign intelligence. And Yisr Harel, he employed terrorism in his operations. And that's one reason why he was forced to resign from the Mossad in 1963, because he was involved in an assassination tactic of killing German scientists called Operation Damocles, which was being run by Yitzhak Shamir. But the thing is that these two men, Zvi Malkin and Avram Shalom Ben-Dor, came to the United States in the 1980s, and these men had been involved in high-level Mossad operations, like the kidnapping of Adolf Eichmann down in Argentina, the former Nazi who was kidnapped, taken to Israel, you know, tried and hanged. And they were also involved in the illegal procurement of plutonium in this country and shipping it to Israel for its nuclear arsenal. So they were very high-level Mossad players, and they came to this country in the 80s. And in 1987, they actually obtained the security contract for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which was the body that owned the World Trade Center. And this is the agency that oversees the ports and the harbors and the airports and the bridges and tunnels of New York City and New Jersey. They obtained the security contract for the World Trade Center and the Port Authority, and this crime of 9/11 probably would have occurred in the late 80s or early 90s had not a person at the Port Authority discovered that Avram Shalom Ben-Dor was convicted of a murder in Israel and was using a false name. And this is the person who was the president of the security company that got the Port Authority contract. It was called Atwell Security of Tel Aviv. And it was actually a company that was set up by the big Mossad guy, Shaul Eisenberg, basically Mr. Asia for Israel. And when the Port Authority discovered that Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor was using a fake name and was wanted or was convicted of murder in Israel as the former chief of the Shin Bet, they tore up the contract. And as I said, had they not torn up the contract, 9/11 would have probably occurred in the late 80s or early 90s. But it was discovered, the contract was torn up, but that wasn't the end of the operation. What they then did is Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor went to work for Jules Krull. And Jules Krull and Maurice Greenberg, they had a company together called Krull Associates. And Krull Associates got the security contract for the World Trade Center after the bombing in 1993. So you see, using the offices of this American Jules Krull, the Mossad still got into the security contract for the World Trade Center. But it took them until 1993 to do so.
You're listening to the voice of Christopher Bolin. He is a researcher and independent journalist and author. He is the author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. This is a 325-page book that we are offering today on this KPFA fundraiser for a tax-deductible donation of $100 to KPFA, $100, and we will be delighted to provide you with Christopher Bolin's Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, a $100 donation. We'd love to get some of you on the phone before we go back to this interview, which I did with Christopher Bolin yesterday morning. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. We come to you every Wednesday on KPFA from 1 to 2 p.m. 1-800-439-5732. We are actually offering three books. We have Christopher Bolin's a book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, for a $100 donation. We have two anthologies. Two anthologies that are each edited by Kevin Barrett. His brand new one, another French, another French false flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino, and also his book on the Charlie Hebdo attacks, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. That for a $100 donation. You can get all three blockbuster books for a pledge to KPFA of $280. So let's hear it for a few of you out there that can afford to support Free Speech Radio at the $280 level. That would be absolutely terrific. And of course, your donations to KPFA are tax deductible. 1-800-439-5732. You won't hear about these books, these researchers, or this content on any other radio network. This is why it is so very important to support the Pacifica Radio Network. Pacifica's been around since 1949, and we've got to keep Pacifica going for, let's see, what that would have been, 67 years. Okay, well, let's keep Pacifica going for another 67 years. You're not going to hear this content, this kind of a broadcast, or about these books or these authors anywhere else. Please give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. $100 for any one of these three books. Today we're featuring Christopher Bullen's Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. Whatever you think of Christopher Bullen's thesis, this is a book you need to read. You need to read the evidence, the research. Very important book. 1-800-439-5732. We're also offering another French false flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. That has 27 different authors. The anthologies, of course, are compilations of papers, essays written by different authors. And actually, even in Christopher Bullen's Solving 9/11, each of the chapters stand alone because they're on a different aspect of the attacks of September 11th. So none of these books are books that you have to read from page one to the end. You can pick up and read a chapter anywhere. These are easy to read books. I know that lots of listeners like to get DVDs, movies. Those are very popular. But, you know, I remain convinced that to really get something, to get the most out of a subject, you really need to read a book. Very, very important. $100 contribution for either one of these books. Today we're featuring Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World by Christopher Bullen. He was just here in San Francisco last Tuesday night, a week ago. I was fortunate enough to be able to attend his blockbuster two-hour presentation with 140 slides. Powerful, powerful presentation. And I met a lot of fans of Guns of Butter, of KPFA, of Christopher Bullen. We all sort of showed up at the last moment there. It was quite an event. 1-800-439-5732. Of course, you can always pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I think you have to navigate to books, and you will find all of these books under the tax-deductible donations to KPFA of $100. Of course, a $25 donation makes you a member of KPFA for an entire year. It will enable you to vote in a very important upcoming KPFA local station board elections. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Please step up. Give us a call. Very, very important show today. Very important books. All three of these books are very important. You could actually get all three of them for $280. Either one of them for $100, all three for $280. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I'd like to thank each and every one of you who have called to support KPFA, to support Guns and Butter. So very important to keep the Pacifica Radio Network on the air. Christopher Bullen goes where most other researchers don't, with the exception, of course, of Kevin Barrett, and we're offering two of his anthologies as well. We have Solving 9/11 by Christopher Bullen. We have another French false flag, and We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. Those are both anthologies. 1-800-439-5732. too. Well, let's see if we can hear a little bit more of this interview that I did with Christopher Bolin yesterday morning. What do you think, Erica? Well, then, what company or companies held the security contract for the World Trade Center on September 11th?
Well, it was Kroll Associates. Kroll Associates, headed by Jules Kroll and his son, and then involving Maurice Greenberg and his son, they had the Kroll Associates. They were given the duty to rewrite procedures, security procedures for the World Trade Center, and they did so. This is after the bombing in 1993, and the 1993 bombing in the basement was basically an FBI sting operation, and it was investigated for the city of New York for the Robert Morgenthau, the DA of New York. It was investigated by a guy named Cherkasky. I think his name is Michael Cherkasky. And he was the head of investigations for New York City and for Robert Morgenthau. And then the following year, Mr. Cherkasky went to work for Kroll Associates when they became the organization that was in charge of security for the World Trade Center. And the Port Authority took all of their recommendations and put them into effect. And this group, Kroll Associates, then had the security contract for the World Trade Center and oversaw security for the World Trade Center all the way through to the destruction in 2001.
Could you explain the relationship of Kroll Associates with Marsh and McLennan? Who are the people involved in these companies?
Well, it's Jules Kroll and his business partner, Maurice Greenberg, also known as Hank Greenberg, who was the former CEO of AIG, the company that got the lion's share of the $180 billion bailout in 2008 and 2009. These two men have several companies together, and one of them is Marsh McLennan. And Marsh McLennan is the company into whose computer room the first plane struck. The very first plane went right into Marsh McLennan's secure computer center, which was in the North Tower. And Kroll Associates and Maurice Greenberg, they have several companies together. Maurice Greenberg has a whole bunch of, operations with Jules Kroll. And their sons are also involved, Jules Kroll's son and Maurice Greenberg's son. Maurice Greenberg's son, for example, was the CEO of Marsh McLennan when the first plane struck their computer room. And this is very important because both planes actually struck secure computer rooms. And both computer rooms seem to have been prepared with thermite charges and things like that so that the explosion was, spectacular and pyrotechnical. But those are the people, those two characters, Greenberg and Kroll, they're very important because Kroll Associates also involved people like Jerome Hauer. Jerome Hauer had been a Kroll associate, and he was the guy in San Diego who came on and said, basically that this was the 9/11 was done by Osama bin Laden, and the towers fell because of the burning fuel. Another one was Paul Bremer, who was the first head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, I think it was called the CPA, in Iraq. He was basically America's proconsul to run the occupation of Iraq for the first 3 or 4 years, during which time, there was no metering of the oil that was being exported from Iraq. All of these characters are at the highest level of the Iraqi invasion, the invasion of Iraq, and 9/11. I mean, even Jerome Hauer, who was a Kroll Associates employee, was the person who put the Office of Emergency Management hard bunker on the 23rd floor of building number 7, the building that fell down at 5:20 in the afternoon. So, I mean, these people are all connected. This small group of players are very deeply connected in the crimes of 9/11 and the atrocity of what happened on 9/11 and then the war in Iraq.
You just mentioned the hardened bunker in Building 7. That was Giuliani's Emergency Management Control Center? Wasn't that right?
Yes. Yeah, Office of Emergency Management, OEM. And that OEM was managed by Jules Kroll, a Kroll associate employee, Jerome Hauer. And Jerome Hauer is the person who oversaw and made the decision to put this hardened bunker on the 23rd floor of that building. And this hardened bunker was built in such a way that it would withstand even a nuclear blast in the area. And what's interesting is that the OEM bunker, the 23rd floor, was not occupied on 9/11 by the usual people. There had been a planned FEMA operation drill scenario. And so in order for this scenario to go ahead, they had removed the usual people from the OEM bunker, and they were working at another location in New York City on 9/11. So that meant that somebody else was in the OEM bunker that day. And most likely, this is where the demolition operation was carried out that destroyed the Twin Towers.
And then what happened to that OEM bunker?
Well, the whole thing came down in a big pile of debris at 5:25 in the afternoon that day. This is the third building that fell down. And, you know, it wasn't talked about very much in the media. So most American people, I mean, a good percentage of the American population is unaware of this building coming down. And this is the aspect of 9/11 that has gotten many people involved in the truth movement. People like Stephen Jones from BYU, when he discovered Building 7 coming down for no apparent reason, he became interested. And the same thing with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, for example, Richard Gage. This is where they begin their discussion, because this building fell down into its own footprint in what's clearly a demolition operation at 5:25 in the afternoon. There were just some, you know, it was two blocks away from the World Trade Center, and it was separated by a building in between, and it just had some little fires, office fires. There's no reason for the building to come crashing down into its footprint, but that's exactly what happened. So it's one of the most obvious clues that the buildings at the World Trade Center were demolished.
Yes, and when I interviewed 9/11 whistleblower Indira Singh, she actually told me that there was, of course, foreknowledge of Building 7 coming down, because she was an emergency medical technician doing triage out in front of Building 7 when the fire department around noon on September 11th had the EMTs move up to Pace University, because according to the fire department there, Building 7 was going to come down.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I mean there's videos out there of people coming out of Building 7 like at 5:00 in the afternoon or 5:15 in the afternoon, and they're telling people, including Amy Goodman is in one of these videos, they're saying get back, get away, this building's gonna come down, keep your eye on that building, it's gonna come down. So I mean there's a lot of people who obviously knew that Building 7 was wired for demolition and was gonna come down, and these are the people who had placed the charges or had prepared the building in the last minute for its destruction. There's no question. There's really no question that the building was demolished and that it was planned for. I mean, even Larry Silverstein, the owner of the building, the person who built the building back in 1985, he admitted on public television that, you know, the decision was made to pull the building and then we watched it come down. And he said that on a TV program. And to pull a building means to basically pull the structure so that it falls. It's a demolition term. There's no question about it. The building was blown up. And, you know, this is the beginning of, as I said, this is the beginning when people realize that we have been lied to about 9/11. Every aspect that we've been told by the government about 9/11 is basically a lie.
Do you think the high-tech enterprise architecture company PTEC was compromised? You write that their enterprise software was used to provide real-time access and control of all data and information on government computer networks on September 11th.
Yes. Yes. This is also part of Indira Singh's contribution to 9/11 understanding. Yeah, PTEC was more than compromised. PTEC was basically an Israeli operation, and it was enterprise software based in Quincy, Massachusetts. And it was what I call like a false front operation, in which people were led to believe that it was a Lebanese Muslim who had set up the company, and that this company had been sponsored by some dodgy Saudi guy who has some ties to terrorism. This is all part of the deception. In fact, the person who was playing the key role in the establishment of the company from the beginning in 1994 and getting its software, its enterprise software, onto U.S. military and government computers was a man named Michael Goff, a Jewish guy from Worcester, Massachusetts, who was a lawyer. And Michael Goff, what he did is that I spoke to him and I asked him how he wound up working for PTEC. And he said that he had left his law practice in Worcester, Mass. He was working for a good company out there. And he left that law firm and went to work through an agency for PTEC, which was a little startup company in 1994. And I asked him, well, what agency was that? What agency, you know, was responsible for your going? He couldn't remember. So I think he was not telling me the truth here. And what's interesting is that Michael Goff went on to work for the Mossad company Guardium, which is another computer software company, Guardium with an M at the end. And that's a very clearly an Israeli intelligence operation. So he's working on one hand for Israeli intelligence, and on the other hand, he's working for PTEC, this dodgy little Arab startup company in Quincy, Mass., whose software finds itself onto all the computers in the United States government military. Well, you know, I think I pinned the tail on the donkey when I say that PTEC was an Israeli intelligence front operation all along. And this is how you do spying in the big, big picture. When you have enterprise software running on U.S. government computers, you know what's going on in the operation, in the computer network, whichever agency you're talking about. You have absolute control, surveillance operability, and control operability throughout the operation in real time. That is intelligence gathering at the highest level.
9/11 whistleblower Indira Singh said that PTEC was with MITRE Corporation in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11. What do we know about MITRE Corporation?
Well, MITRE Corporation is based out of MIT originally, and it's part of Lincoln Labs, which is a company that does all of the the engineering, software engineering, and things like that for the U.S. Air Force. MITRE Corporation is a very big defense contractor. It's based outside Boston. And these two companies were involved, as she said, in the basement of the FAA, checking for and examining the relationship between the FAA and the military in the event of a crisis like 9/11. I've written a great deal about MITRE and PTEC and the people involved in this. And again, there's this very strong Zionist influence in MITRE. The former CEO and the people that ran it, James Schlesinger was in there. Rodney Schlesinger, I think, might be. But in any case, this whole operation was basically being done to prepare the understanding and to put the super users in charge of how the communication would flow from the FAA to the military when 9/11 occurred. And this is a very important part of the computer aspect of the crime, because as we now know, there was a drill going on that day and the air traffic controllers were completely befuddled and didn't understand what was real and what was false that day. But also the communications between the FAA and the military were thwarted and delayed, so that there was no proper, effective military response to the hijackings. And this is not by accident. This is done by a very intelligent foe who has infiltrated the most important and sensitive computer networks involved in defense of this country. And that's where we have a very serious problem. You know, that the Israeli military intelligence has infiltrated the computer networks of the U.S. government and military, so that they have this super user access to these computer networks. And it went on even in later on. The NSA itself took encryption software from an Israeli company, and I called up the NSA and I said, I mean, how is it that the NSA, you're the signal intelligence of the United States of America, and you give your encryption software, you know, responsibility over to a foreign country? They had no problem with that, they said. But I mean, that just gives you an idea of how infiltrated our computer networks are. And it's the same thing what we found out later when with this revelations by Snowden, and I think it was Assange, but the Snowden revelations revealed that in San Francisco, the companies that were involved, I think one was called Prism, another was called Narus, these two companies that were involved in the splitting of the rays and sending the data in real time directly to Israel were both Israeli companies. So what we find is that, you know, at the highest level and the computer networks in this country, military and government, they're completely infiltrated and controlled by Israeli intelligence. Even the cybersecurity czar for the Pentagon was a guy named Amit Yoran, and he's an Israeli, and he and his brother, you know, ran this network of hackers, friendly hackers, whatnot. But these are the people who wrote the security protocols for the Pentagon, for the security software. And he was the cybersecurity czar for the United States of America, and he's an Israeli citizen. You know, this is how bad it is.
What is the Site Intelligence Group? Who runs it and what do they do? That's SITE.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very important. Site Intelligence Group is a Israeli intelligence website operation based in Bethesda, Maryland. And the front person for this organization is an Israeli intelligence agent named Rita Katz, K-A-T-Z. And she works out of Bethesda, Maryland. And what this group does is it provides the video feed coming from, for example, ISIS. One of their main clients or main subjects is this Islamic State group in Syria and Iraq. So when we see videos coming from this ISIS group, what is coming to us through this Israeli intelligence website called Site Intelligence Group. And so what it basically means is that our understanding of this Islamic threat in Syria and Iraq called ISIS is most of the time primarily coming to us through these Israelis. And that's very important to understand. This is a good example of how U.S. military and U.S. media view the Middle East through Israeli spectacles, because they are the ones who are providing us with the so-called intelligence, the propaganda, the videos, what have you. And so it's very much like the wag the dog, you know, theme of the movie, in which videos are being provided to us from an Israeli website supposedly portraying this latest threat to, you know, peace in the Middle East. And that's very important to understand, because when, for example, the second video or the video of the second American being beheaded came to, you know, CNN and Fox News, it came from Site, and Site admitted on CNN that they had actually released, Site Intelligence Group had released the video before ISIS had released the video. And as Rita Katz said on CNN, well, this is because we had a copy of the video beforehand. Well, how did the Israeli intelligence have a copy of the video beforehand, before ISIS had actually released the video, unless they're inside the camera? This gives you an idea of how close Israeli intelligence is to this ISIS operation.
That's Christopher Bolin. He is the author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. Our thank you gift today on KPFA Fund Drive for a tax-deductible donation of $100 to Free Speech Radio, KPFA, to the Pacifica Network. Your contributions keep this very important radio network on the air. You can help us out here, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. This is the last time that I will come to you during this KPFA fund drive. We really need to get some more support here for the work of Christopher Bolin. In that interview that I did yesterday, we go on to discuss foreknowledge of 9/11 in Hollywood movies. And the producers of these movies, the close relationship between Netanyahu and Larry Silverstein, I didn't know that. He talks about the Likud, the Irgun, and the Stern Gang. We'll air the full produced show, hour-long show, next week on Guns and Butter, Wednesdays at 1 o'clock. And that's all we can play for you today, but we need to raise some money for KPFA. The KPFA, the station that brings you Guns and Butter every Wednesday at 1 o'clock, we need people to call and support this station. 1-800-439-5732. 5732 and securely online at kpfa.org. A tax deductible donation of $100, and we can provide you with Christopher Bolin's book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. This is 325 pages. What's he got? He's got like 16 chapters. 9/11 Through the Eyes of an American Skeptic, The Planes of 9/11, America the Target, 9/11 and Israel's History of False Flag Terrorism, The Terror Drills That Became Real, 9/11, The London Bombings, and The Sinking of Estonia. That's the fourth chapter. Why did crucial computer systems fail? The Florida Connection. The Architecture of Terror, Mapping the Network Behind 9/11. We started to talk about this earlier in the interview, but it is so complicated. You really have to read the chapter. There's so many interlocking companies involved. It was really too much to go into in an interview. Then he does the media cover-up. The secluded mastermind of 9/11, who controls our political parties, PTEC and the financial crisis, why did iron boil beneath the rubble, the discovery of thermite in the dust, Ehud Barak and 9/11, the destruction of the evidence, and making sense of the 9/11 cover-up. 1-800-439-5732, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. A thank you gift for a $100 tax deductible contribution to KPFA. You can pledge securely online. One person has. I hope a few more of you can go online and pledge at kpfa.org. A $25 donation, as always, makes you a member for a year. Those are very important, those $25 contributions. I've been told many times that if everybody who listened to the station donated $25, we wouldn't even have to have any fund drives. So how about that? Let's hear it for some $25 donations. And, of course, $100, we can provide you with Christopher Bolin's book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. Any of the three books we're offering today for a $100 tax-deductible donation, the two anthologies by Kevin Barrett, Another French False Flag, and We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. But you need to give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. You know, you just heard Christopher Bolin mention the National Security Agency. Also, all of these agencies that that a foreign government actually has access to all of the data. It's actually quite shocking, and I'm very surprised that more people aren't concerned about that. 1-800-439-5732. There is an awful lot of research and information in Christopher Bolin's Solving 9/11. It's a must-read, in my opinion. Whatever you think of his thesis, it's a very, very important book. And in he covers, of course, Christopher Bolin goes where most other researchers don't go. And that's what makes the book important. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We very much need your support. We're winding down. We've only got a few more days to go, and we've got a lot of money to raise here at KPFA. So please give us a call, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. I mentioned a little bit earlier that Christopher Bolin, actually, darn it, I forgot, he's on a tour of the United States. And I was going to announce his next stops. He has six more presentations, and doggone it, I forgot his schedule. But you can go to bolin.com and get his schedule. He's up in Vancouver right now, but he's already had an event there. He moves on to Montana, Ohio. You could go to bolin.com and see his schedule. I'd like to thank a few people who have called in to support this show, to support the work of Christopher Bolin, to support the work of of Kevin Barrett, but most of all to keep KPFA and Pacifica a network on the air. That's why people call in and donate, is because we need to support this network. Hey, Kevin, thank you. You know, Kevin in our, not Kevin Barrett, but our Kevin here, our volunteer here at KPFA is bringing me a few of your pledge cards. I'd like to thank Chris Date in Healdsburg, big supporter of KPFA and Guns and Butter. Thank you, Chris. Thank you to Sam Jones. No city there, but thank you, Sam. And I'd like to also thank Claire Fetter in Atherton. Thank you, Claire. You can join these supporters of KPFA of Pacifica by giving us a call at 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. A $100 tax deductible donation, and we would be delighted to send you any one of these three books. You can get all three of them for a $280 tax deductible donation. I'd like to thank Inga Barros in Campbell. Thank you. Also, a big thank you to Fred Brunswick in Walnut Creek. Also, thank you to Marcia Holmquist in San Anselmo. San Anselmo. Thank you, Marcia. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. We just got an online pledge from Visalia. Terrific. Well, now those pledges in Visalia will, of course, go to the station in Fresno. So I'd like to encourage those of you who listen to Guns and Butter, who listen to KPFA in the Central Valley. I certainly do when I'm out there on Highway 5. I always tune in to 88.1. And your donations will go to your local station. 1-800-439-5732. And of course, if you want to, people listening online that are in other parts of the country, if you'd like to catch Christopher Bolin in the Midwest, on the East Coast, go to bolin.com, and he has the rest of his schedule posted there. I'd like to thank Marilyn Byrne in Redlands. Okay, thank you, Marilyn. That's near where I grew up. So Marilyn is listening online at kpfa.org. So thank you, Marilyn. 1-800-439-5732. I mentioned a little bit earlier that at the very last minute, this last week, I got a call from Christopher Bolin, and he had added a stop in the Bay Area. He wasn't scheduled to be in the Bay Area, but Brad Olson, a big fan of Christopher Bolin's, at the very last minute, there was only one day's notice online that he was going to give his two-hour presentation at the Presidio Library in the Richmond, a nice little library, and a bunch of us dedicated types showed up for that. People who listened to KPFA, people who listened to Guns and Butter showed up. We were a relatively small group because it was such a last-minute deal, but Kevin White was there, Brad Olson, of course, who was hosting Christopher, Danny Ames. I got to meet Danny Ames, who's a big fan of the show, and his wonderful son, Dylan. They were there, along with Scott Munson and Roger Boris. He was there with his coffee. He provides coffee to supporters of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I think he calls it Wake Up and Smell the Coffee. And other people there, wonderful people. And, of course, we all went out afterwards for a bite to eat and a long discussion. That's always fun when Christopher Bolin comes to town. We hang around and have a discussion late into the night. We're offering his book. I've got a couple of minutes to go, Solving 9/11. The Deception That Changed the World, 1-800-439-5732, that for a $100 donation to KPFA. I'd like to thank Gwen Richardson in Oakland, California. Thank you, Gwen. Gwen called up and pledged. You can support Gwen and the other people that have supported Pacifica, free speech. You know, there's an awful lot out there on the Internet, but Pacifica is the one radio network that is terrestrial, that reaches people who are not already clued in, who maybe are flipping the dial, and they find us. And this is information that comes to people over the airwaves. Very special, Pacifica Radio Network. Please go to gunsandbutter.org. In the next 2 to 3 weeks, I am going to post the 2-hour presentation that Christopher Bolin gave in San Francisco, along with 140 slides. It is powerful, it's dynamite, and I recorded it, and I was so happy to bring it to you. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Thank you so very much for your support.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, two films by Temujin Duran. One is based on Chris Hedges' work, so it's scary but true. The other is sweet and optimistic. It's all about the slogan, keep calm and carry on. I hope you'll stay tuned. If we wanted to be topical, we'd sure have plenty to talk about this week. For one, it's Labor Day. For another, it's the 50th anniversary of the Great March on Washington and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. I will note that all the mainstream corporate media that are now celebrating the march and praising King, these same media all denounced the march and denounced King while it was happening. The establishment media liked King even less a few years later when he came out strongly against the Vietnam War. Then they liked him least of all when he came out in favor of economic justice. You can always depend on the corporate media fearlessly championing the cause of established power. This is why, yet again, I felt a strong sinking feeling of deja vu all over again when I opened up the paper on August 29. There, on the editorial pages of East of the River's preeminent Daily Rag, there before me, all of the big guns were aimed at Syria. Both of the two editorial cartoons depicted President Assad as a homicidal psychopath. Below one cartoon, right-wing columnist David Ignatius has the headline, American Credibility is at Stake in Syria. To add a little balance, right-wing columnist Eugene Robinson's headline is, Assad Must Be Punished. For yet another perspective, there's a guest editorial from the Worcester Telegram, headlined, Assad Crosses the Line. And for a change of pace, the paper's own editorial suggests that we not send the Marines to invade Syria. Instead, it says that we should fund the Syrian rebel forces that are trying to overthrow their country's government. It's Saddam Hussein all over again. Once again, the world has a new Hitler, and for the good of humanity, he must be overthrown immediately. It's uncanny how these new Hitlers keep emerging in countries that have lots of oil. First Saddam Hussein of Iraq, then Gaddafi of Libya, and now Assad of Syria. The idea of leaving Syria alone, the idea of letting Syria fight its own civil war without the United States intervening to support any side, apparently that course of action is so cowardly, so un-American, so unhelpful to corporate profits and the national security state that the media are not even mentioning that as a possibility. This is a main point of essayist Chris Hedges. The collusion among the corporations, the corporate-owned news media, the government, and the government-owned military machine. This collusion brings us high corporate profits and constant war, and constant propaganda aimed at getting the people to think that constant war is perfectly normal, even desirable. Which brings us to today's feature. British photographer and filmmaker Temujin Duran has made a new film called Obey, How the Rise of Mass Propaganda Killed Populism. I found the film's video too artsy and distracting. The audio is very good. He reads selections from Chris Hedges' 2010 book, The Death of the Liberal Class, with some background music. It really puts today's newspaper headlines in context. We'll hear about half the movie today, the rest next week. And after we pause the film today, we'll lighten up a bit with a short film called Keep Calm. Here is Temujin Duran's Obey.
At any given moment, there is an orthodoxy, a body of ideas which it is assumed that all right-thinking people will accept without question. It is not exactly forbidden to say this, that, or the other, but it is not done to say it, just as in mid-Victorian times it was not done to mention trousers in the presence of a lady. We are an animal of habit. We live, fight, we bleed, and ultimately die for our habits, and those very habits shape the world around us and dictate how we might lead our lives. Before long, it soon becomes difficult to shift our behaviour from anything that we are not familiar with. This is a film about you, me, and the routine of obedience. It is an attempt to show what it means to be obedient in a time where our habits will ultimately shape a world in which we will no longer wish to live. The world as it is today is a place where companies have replaced countries. It is no longer the governments of countries that decide how things run and how people live. Instead, prime ministers have been replaced by directors, presidents with CEOs, parliaments with board members, and civil servants with business strategists. Dominant shareholders drive policies, not constituents. Former world leaders leave administrations to return to work for banks or giant investment firms, whilst we scout for the next generation of politicians from successful corporations, as if to imply that running a profitable company is like representing and deciding how people are to live their lives. It was not long ago that we saw big businessmen as people to be wary of, but somehow we have invited them to lead our countries. We unite behind brands, behind celebrities rather than behind nations. We have become more than nation states. We are corporation states. But how did this happen? At what point did business replace government? Unregulated capitalism had proved itself to be deeply flawed in the Great Depression. So why is it everywhere today? The war effort in the 1940s created a demand for big business to manufacture bombs, tanks, aircraft, and all manner of other war materials. Many companies adjusted their assembly lines to suit the needs of war. It was highly profitable. The war also unleashed radical new forms of mass propaganda that made it possible to engineer public opinion. There were revolutions in radio, cinema, photography, cheap mass publications, and graphic art. This new propaganda exploited recent understandings of mass psychology and its pioneers like Sigmund Freud. Their works became the basis of communication and how individuals would interact with each other. War propaganda was churned out to rally people against a cause, to unite a country, and get citizens behind the war effort. As the war persisted, corporate profits boosted the US economy, and people began to readdress their criticism of the capitalist system. But the war also destroyed long-held values and self-perceptions that had once characterized contemporary life. It replaced them with fear, distrust, and the hedonism of the consumer society. Before the 1940s, there existed many mass movements enraged by the abuses of business. But this new propaganda drove any and all competing ideas and values underground. It vilified all who did not speak in the language of business and state. War propaganda not only bolstered support of the war, but also discredited dissidents and reformers as traitors. This rise of mass propaganda effectively killed populism. It began the death of the traditionally liberal forces that could offer a resistance to the capitalist machine. For this mass propaganda to work, the state could not do it alone. They hired corporations to help them talk to the people. The origins of all modern advertisement, all mass communications, has its foundations in war. And as the Second World War drew to a close, big business, anxious to maintain their high wartime profits, eagerly looked on to where the next conflict might emerge. To ensure financial security during the Cold War, giant US corporations began to split their manufacturing lines throughout the US to provide as many jobs in as many states as possible. In this way, they had a powerful influence over the government. No member of Congress would risk action against a corporation that provides high number of jobs to people in their constituency for fear of a voter backlash. So these businesses could essentially control the way in which Congress would make decisions and choose how policy would be made to favor a corporate profit. This was a huge advance in the privatization of the US government, and from here on, priorities were increasingly made according to what was good for corporations rather than what was good for the people. Government media began to be replaced with corporate media. The quaint literary serials, local reports, town debates, and other forms of popular expression vanished from newspapers. It was replaced by celebrity gossip, the new angry rhetoric of the Cold War, and nationally syndicated columns. Papers became commercialized and centralized. The business of mass propaganda also brought in vast sums of advertising revenue to the media, but corporate and government propaganda narrowed the parameters of acceptable debate. It began the consolidation of the press by huge companies that would end with nearly everything we see, hear, and read disseminated from roughly half a dozen corporations. And for all of Rupert Murdoch's talk of ending the reign of the elites, he presided over the rise of media monopolization. It turned the news into the elite's echo chamber. Today, the privatization of government functions is enormous. In the United States, there are 18 military and civilian intelligence agencies, and 70% of their combined budget is outsourced to corporations. The Pentagon has privatized 69% of its workforce. The Afghanistan war effort is almost wholly privatized. Businesses now run wars and play more part in international conflicts than any state does. Corporations have 35,000 lobbyists in Washington and thousands more in state capitals that dole out corporate money to shape and write legislation. They use committees to solicit employees and shareholders for huge donations in order to fund business-friendly politicians. It is now a global practice, from the Politburo of China to the British Parliament. Labour leaders make lavish salaries and are considered junior partners within corporate capitalism, as long as they do not speak in the language of class struggle. Politicians, like generals, are loyal to the demands of the corporate state in power. They retire to become millionaires as lobbyists or company managers. Artists who use their talents to foster the myths and illusions that bombard our society live comfortably in the Hollywood Hills. Journalists who prize access to the powerful more than they prize the truth report lies and propaganda to propel us into wars around the world. Education has experienced a similar corporate takeover. Suffering from cuts in government funding, these institutions have transformed themselves into vocational schools. They have become breeding grounds for system managers trained to serve the corporate state. Many of these universities have swelled the budgets of their departments with millions in corporate money. University deans, paid enormous salaries as if they were heads of investment banks, are judged almost solely on their ability to raise money. The arts, just as hungry as the media for corporate money and sponsorship, refuse to address the social and economic disparities that create suffering for tens of millions of citizens. Commercial artists peddle mythical narratives, once propagated by corporations, self-help gurus, Oprah Winfrey and the Christian right, that if we dig deep enough within ourselves, focus on happiness, find our inner strength, or believe in miracles, we can have everything we desire. We inhabit a system of inverted totalitarianism, the political coming of age of corporate power and the political demobilization of the citizen. Inverted totalitarianism differs from classical forms of totalitarianism, which revolve around a demagogue or charismatic leader. It finds its expression in the anonymity of the corporate state. The corporate forces behind inverted totalitarianism do not replace decaying structures with new revolutionary ones. They do not import new symbols or iconography as classic totalitarianism movements do. They do not offer a radical alternative. Corporate power claims to honor electoral politics, freedom, and constitutions, but these corporate forces corrupt and manipulate power as to make democracy impossible. We have yet to fully grasp that corporations are not concerned with the common good. They exploit, pollute, impoverish, repress, kill, and lie to make money. They throw poor families out of homes, let the uninsured die, wage useless wars to make profits, poison and pollute the ecosystem, slash social assistance programs, gut public education, trash the global economy, plunder the government treasuries and crush all popular movements that seek justice for working men and women. They worship money and power. Capitalism is a revolutionary force that consumes greater and greater numbers of human lives until finally it consumes itself, leaving nothing but a dead zone. Corporations have seized power from the hands of the citizens, that the constitutions and all guarantees of personal liberty have become irrelevant, and that the phrase consent of the governed is meaningless. We experience nothing more than hollow acts of political theatre, all happening under the guise that democratic debate continue to exist, when in fact they do not. This is the world as it is. It is global and it is what we obey. The vague and unspecific promise of a better tomorrow is all that politicians have left to offer. It is only with this system of unfettered capitalism that they promise us the brighter future that awaits us, our brave new world. This is the future of the current system. This is the future of obedience. In the coming years, corporate power will continue to pollute and poison the ecosystem and propel us into a world where there will be only masters and serfs. There will be no check to a system of governance designed to enrich a tiny elite and plunder an entire planet. Liberals, socialists, trade unionists, independent journalists, and intellectuals, many of whom had once important voices in our society, will be banished and muzzled by corporate control through academia, culture, the media, and government. It will create a power vacuum filled by speculators, war profiteers, gangsters, and killers. Patriotic system, plagued by fear of job losses and possible terrorist attacks, will give their support to widespread surveillance and the militarized state. Military and intelligence agencies will be held above government, as if somehow they are not part of the government. The most powerful instruments of state control will effectively have no public oversight. The money that could be used to house and provide food and health to millions will be channeled to the development of increasingly sophisticated weaponry, like drones or AGM-144 Hellfire missiles, which suck the air out of victims' lungs. And yet the civic, patriotic, political language we will use to describe ourselves will remain unchanged. We will find our collective identity in the same national symbols. We will continue to deify our nation's founders, our leaders from history. But the countries we celebrate will become illusions. They will not exist. At first, people will indulge in the habit of intellectual avoidance. You will not want to appear to be political. You will be afraid of seeming controversial. You will want to keep a reputation for being balanced, objective, and moderate. Your hope is to be asked back, to consult, to be on a board or prestigious committee, and so to remain within the responsible mainstream. You will be employed. The mass propaganda used by the power elite will employ the talents of many people, and the work of justifying corporate power will continue to be carried out by an educated elite drawn from liberal thinkers. It is these people who will continue to create the jingles, advertising, brands, and mass-produced entertainment that keeps us trapped in a cultural and political illusion. The corporate salaries that these individuals earn will sap their moral and intellectual independence. It is one of the ironies of corporate control that the corporate state needs the abilities of intellectuals to maintain power. Yet outside of this role, it will continue its refusal to permit intellectuals to think or function independently. Hollywood, the news industry, and television will increasingly become instruments of inverted totalitarianism. They will saturate the airwaves with manufactured controversy, whether it is a political sex scandal, or the dispute between talk show hosts, or the extramarital affairs of celebrities. We will confuse knowledge with our potted responses to these non-events. Those who continue to resist will become members of the underclass. As long as they collaborate with the power elite and merge with the instruments of corporate oppression, there will be a few positions of comfort and privilege. But all those who seek to work as artists, journalists, professors, labor organizers, dissident politicians, or clergy will increasingly struggle without adequate health insurance or reliable incomes. Newspapers and print culture will disappear completely, supplanted by the blogosphere, the social media universe, and interactive television. Ironically, we will watch an increasingly number of so-called reality shows. But reality will leave our culture. It will be seeded for a culture of emotionally driven narratives, where facts and opinions are interchangeable. A fantasy reality, where meaning is distorted, when words or sentences arrive in only bite-sized forms, and are taken out of context, alongside emotionally charged images. Words and images will dismember reality, and it will leave dissidents speaking in a language that will often be unintelligible to the wider society. As we shift from print to image, the old artifacts grounded in print will become as obtuse and unintelligible as hieroglyphics. News images will offer us an endless whirlwind of emotion, and at the same time create a historical amnesia. We will forget how we got here. A populace entranced by these fragments, pictures, videos, and spectacles, a populace that can no longer find the words to articulate what is happening to it, is cut off from rational discourse. We will express our reality through the use of selected and isolated facts, half-truths or lies that do not make sense. Illusion will become true. The great promise of the internet to open up dialogue, break down cultural barriers, promote democracy and unleash innovation and creativity is just a utopian dream. It will instead accelerate our division into antagonistic clans, where we are sucked into virtual tribal groups that chant the same slogans and hate the same enemies. Internet trolls will become digital crowd mobs. The web, like cable news outlets, will form anonymous crowds to vent collective rage, intolerance and bigotry. Utopian promoters of the internet will insist that the hive mind, a vast virtual collective, will propel us towards a brave new world. But this simply is not true. The internet is populated by the crowd and not the hive, and the crowd can turn into a mob all too easily. The internet will starve professional critics and artists. The only journalism and art that will endure will be that which draws advertising. The only income left for most of those who create will be earned through the self-promotion and the orchestration of celebrity. Writers, musicians, artists, journalists, and filmmakers must transform themselves into celebrities to earn money or vanish from the public consciousness. Cultural and artistic expression will be replaced by the tawdry, banal, and often idiotic distractions that draw huge numbers of views on YouTube. The internet will complete the final assault on the arts and intellectual inquiry. Any work that cannot gain corporate sponsorship or attract advertising revenue will be ignored. And funding a civilization through advertising is like trying to get nutrition by connecting a tube from one's anus to one's mouth.
And on that sad and depressing note, let us pause the film for now. More next week. That's Temujin Duran's film, Obey, featuring words from Death of the Liberal Class by Chris Hedges. I've been noticing here and there a poster. It has a crown and then five words, keep calm and carry on. Where the heck is that from? It sounds like a quote from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, or maybe Monty Python. But how come I never heard the phrase until now? It turns out that it's a real slogan, invented in World War II, but never used. There's a charming story to it, and it's well told by Temujin Duran in another movie of his called Keep Calm.
In the spring of 1939, during the build-up to war with Germany, the British government commissioned a series of propaganda posters. These posters were intended to offer the public reassurance in the dark days that lay ahead. They were required to be uniform in style and were to feature a special and handsome typeface, making them difficult for the enemy to counterfeit. They used the crown of King George VI as the only graphic device and had just two colours. Of the three final designs that went into production, the first poster carried the slogan, "Your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution will bring us victory." The second poster had the words, "Freedom is in peril, defend it with all your might." But the third design, of which over 2.5 million posters were printed, simply read, "Keep calm and carry on." The first two designs were distributed in September of 1939 and appeared up and down the country in shop windows and railway platforms. But the Keep Calm posters were held in reserve, intended for use only in times of crisis or invasion. In the end, the poster was never officially issued, and it remained unseen by the public until a copy turned up more than 50 years later. It was found in a second-hand bookshop called Barter Books in the northeast corner of England. Barter Books was begun in 1991 by a couple, Stuart and Mary Manley. The building used to be an old Victorian railway station. Huge rows of stacked shelves now stand in the place where the tracks would have been, but the station's old tea rooms and waiting rooms are still there. It was in 2000 that Stuart found the poster in a box of dusty old books that had been bought at auction. Mary liked it so much she had it framed and put it up near the shop till, and it proved so popular with the customers that a year later they began to sell copies. Since that time, the poster has been reproduced, parodied, and trivialized, and has become a truly iconic image of the 21st century. It is hard to say exactly why such a phrase from a bygone decade would have so much appeal and resonance now. Its design is considered simple and timeless, and now commonly recognizable. However, it is perhaps the words on the poster that people find most enchanting. Like a voice out of history, it offers a very simple, warm-hearted message to inspire confidence in others during difficult times. And it's something that should never fade from fashion. To keep calm and carry on.
Words for today. Our show began with the words, "I have a dream." It moved on to obey, and ended with keep calm. If you're interested in the history of the past 50 years, there it is in a nutshell. So keep calm, and maybe someday we'll be able to have dreams again. Thanks for listening to New World Notes. For more stuff by Temujin Duran, see his website, studiocanoe.com. For more stuff from us, check out newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Until next week, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, war is not healthy for children and other living things, and keep calm and carry on.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
February 12, 2016, marked the 8th anniversary of 9/11 Wake Up Call. On today's show, I'm going to review some of the key points about 9/11 that have led us to where we are today, with 60% of our budget being spent on, quote, the Defense Department, which would be more aptly named the Department of Aggression and Deception to advance empire than the Defense Department. And I'll tell you about some new projects that you may want to support, and we'll discuss where we're at today in the Middle East, all based on the lies of 9/11. As I see it, 9/11 is the key. If you don't understand how you've been lied to and deceived about 9/11 by the government and corporate media, and even some alternative media that is funded by large foundations or billionaires, you can't really understand accurately what's going on today in the world. And perhaps you won't have the awareness of just how deep the lies, propaganda, and corruption go. And most importantly, we won't be able to do anything about it if a significant number of us still believe the propaganda, disinformation, and misinformation, and outright lies being fed to us by the government and controlled media on a daily basis. So first, let's do a basic review of 9/11, and then we'll connect it to how we got to where we are today. Much of what you'll hear today has been explored in past shows in greater detail and depth, and those shows can be found at the website radioforall.net, and that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, search alphabetically for the name Cheryl with a C, and on page three of the C's, click on my name, and the show should pop up in chronological order. First, there's the organization PNAC, or Project for a New American Century, which was a neocon organization, or neoconservative, that in the late 90s and 2000 were advocating for U.S. full-spectrum dominance of the world, but stated that the American people would never allow it nor support the military spending it would require absent a new Pearl Harbor. Many of the neocons had positions of influence within the Bush administration, and actually, the neocons still have great influence in the Obama administration. 9/11 was their new Pearl Harbor, and your world hasn't been the same since. The official government story, which is also a conspiracy theory, is that 19 Middle Eastern men with box cutters hijacked four planes, two of which flew into the World Trade Center towers, one into the Pentagon, and one that crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. It also goes on to state that the World Trade Centers collapsed due to the fires caused by the jet fuel. There were two government investigations into the events of 9/11. One was the Congressional Joint Inquiry, which happened in 2002, and the other was the 9/11 Commission Report, which came out in 2004. Here are just a few key points that they failed to investigate or mention. There is no evidence that the alleged hijackers were even on the planes. A third World Trade Center tower fell on 9/11 that wasn't hit by a plane. People in the area reported hearing a countdown before the building exploded and collapsed. The government initially identified two alleged hijackers who they had to remove from the list a few days later because one was already dead, and one was still alive and actually worked for the FAA. The FAA employee who discovered that this alleged hijacker worked for the FAA, was actually fired for his investigation into that. Many of the alleged hijackers were trained at U.S. military bases and flight schools prior to 9/11. Many of them were being followed and watched and supported financially by Saudi Arabia. And many were being followed by Israeli art students, particularly in the Florida area, who, as revealed by Carl Cameron on Fox News, turned out to be a spy ring. Barry Jennings, who worked for the city of New York, was in World Trade Center 7 on the morning of 9/11 and went on record stating that explosions had occurred in the building and that he was walking over dead bodies as he tried to get out. In 2008, right before the NIST report came out about how World Trade Center 7 collapsed, supposedly due to fires, Barry Jennings mysteriously died. And his family also had moved without a trace. Philip Marshall, who wrote the book The Big Bamboozle about 9/11 and was discussing the content of another book he wanted to write about 9/11, also turned up dead, supposedly killing his two teenage children, the family dog, and himself. Willie Rodriguez, a janitor in one of the towers, heard explosions going off in the basement of the tower before the plane hit the building. He testified before the 9/11 Commission, but his eyewitness account never made it into the report. And the 9/11 Commission never investigated the possibility of controlled demolition or explosives being used, even in World Trade Center 7, which was not hit by a plane. The things I've just mentioned are just the tip of the iceberg. There are just thousands of these kinds of anomalies and questions that surround 9/11. So there's clearly a cover-up going on. And let's talk for a minute about the two reports. The Congressional Joint Inquiry, which was held in 2002 and led by Senator Bob Graham and House Member Porter Goss, both of whom were from Florida and represented the districts where many of the hijackers trained at flight schools. There was resistance initially to form the joint inquiry. In fact, Senator Daschle received anthrax in the mail when he was considering investigating 9/11. And of course, it's been proven that the anthrax attacks were an inside job. And the joint inquiry, as well as the 9/11 Commission report, did not look into actually what happened and who did it. They just assumed that the official account that it was these 19 Middle Eastern men with box cutters that did it, and then went from there looking at mostly how the different government agencies failed to communicate with each other and making recommendations on how to improve that communication. And the 9/11 Commission only came into existence because the family members forced it into existence. They demanded it. They lobbied Congress. And so it came into existence. All the commissioners were Washington insiders and corporate insiders connected to a lot of big business, military, oil, you name it. And as revealed in Phil Shannon's book called The Commission, Philip Zelikow, who was a close friend of Condoleezza Rice, oversaw the commission and wrote the outline of the 9/11 Commission report before the commission members even met. The chairman of the commission themselves have stated that they were set up to fail. John Farmer, the chief legal counsel of the 9/11 Commission, stated that we don't have the truth about 9/11. There are so many people who question the official fairy tale of 9/11 around the world because of these facts and the thousands more like them. But you'll rarely hear about any of these facts in the controlled prestitute media. And if the controlled prestitute media is your only source of information, then you may already be so indoctrinated to the official account that you can't make sense of what the 9/11 truth movement is all about. And then, of course, there's the CIA-created term, conspiracy theory, designed to keep you from looking deeper. But what I've presented on this show over the last 8 years is not conspiracy theory, but irrefutable facts. And if you haven't already done so, I really encourage you to take the time to look at the facts surrounding 9/11. It's out there. If you look at alternative sources, these facts are out there. And the reason why it's so important that you know what's happened on 9/11, as I mentioned in the beginning, if you don't get that you've been lied to about 9/11, then you can't get and fully understand what's going on in the Middle East today, or even in your own country. Even most of, and perhaps all, of the domestic terrorism events have been traced back to the FBI setting up the patsies to keep you afraid so that you'll support the billions being spent on homeland security and the wars. And you'll willingly give up your civil liberties, thinking that it's the necessary price for security. So let's talk about terrorism and terrorists for a moment. We know that Osama bin Laden worked for the CIA. His name was Tim Osman. And we know that the Mujahideen, later called Al-Qaeda, were created by the CIA to fight the Russians in Afghanistan in the 1980s. There's no evidence that these relationships ever ended. We know that the U.S. and NATO sponsored Operation Gladio in Europe in the 1960s and 70s, instigating terrorist attacks against civilians and blaming it on the communists to keep them from gaining power in Europe. We also know that the U.S., NATO, and their Middle Eastern allies have created, trained, funded, bought oil from, and provided medical treatment for ISIS. Muslims have been demonized so that Americans and Europeans will support the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria. And if you think that we're in these countries to protect freedom and democracy and fight the people who allegedly did 9/11, here's General Wesley Clark in 2007 explaining what it's really all about.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq? Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran." The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you, but there was definitely, there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region.
So they're a little behind schedule. It's taken them so far 14 years instead of 5 to kill, maim, and displace millions of people to get their hands on the oil. And of course, there are other geopolitical reasons for our being in these countries also. One is that they had their own public banks and were not beholden to the IMF or the World Bank. And some were trading or thinking of trading in euros and other currencies and not the dollar. And once these countries are taken over, their public utilities and industries can be opened up to privatization by Western corporations. And of course, there are other geopolitical problems in the Middle East, like the plan for a greater Israel, that are also behind these invasions. So if 9/11 didn't happen, they'd have no excuse to be in these countries killing, maiming, and displacing millions of innocent people for power and profit. That's why they don't want you to know that 9/11 and the global war on terror are all their own fabrications. Of course, now Russia has entered the picture and is actually targeting ISIS in Syria at the request of the Syrian government. This has complicated things, since the U.S., NATO, and its Middle Eastern allies have covertly been creating and supplying ISIS While publicly claiming to fight them, it's become a bit trickier for them to play this game. One of the things they've done is to demonize Vladimir Putin through lots of media lies and disinformation. Of course, none of this deception would be possible without the complicity of the controlled prostitute media, as Paul Craig Roberts calls it. The good news is that author, journalist, and FBI whistleblower Sybelle Edmonds has teamed up with other independent journalists to create a daily independent media source. Their website is newsbud.com, and they're in the organizing and funding stage of development right now. And here's Sybelle Edmonds, Pepe Escobar, and a few other of these independent journalists talking about this new project.
The role of mainstream media has changed over the last few decades from reporting news and conveying information to creating markets and encouraging consumerism. This whole notion of journalistic integrity only exists in theory and in academia. In practice, that entire paradigm has disappeared from both the mainstream media and from the pseudo-alternative media. Because when you have a particular interest group giving you millions of dollars to your news organization for you to be the vehicle to deliver their message and get them close to their objective, that is not journalism. And you see media outlets that consider themselves as public model, whether they're public radio or there's a public TV. But when you really delve into it, you see that less than 20-30% of their funding comes from the public. The rest comes from the mega corporations, from the dynasty families, whether they are Rockefellers or Soros or the Koch brothers, and the various agenda groups. And their interests at no point intersects with the people's interest. And funding is extremely important, because when you have mega corporations, the 0.01% funding your media, they are making the people irrelevant. Well, we are creating here a model that doesn't exist today. Our team is made of seasoned investigative journalists, talented independent producers, podcast and video, editorial cartoonists, analysts, columnists.
What NewsBud wants to do, it's something that on the internet you can see patches here and there, but we'll be trying to do it in a very organized, organic way. From, you know, deep state shenanigans to foreign policy blunders to the new great game all across Eurasia, which is the big story of the future, delivered directly to you, in fact, sponsored by you and financed by you and catering to your own interests and really trying to inform you of what's really going on across the planet.
We know that the mainstream media is bought and paid for. In the pockets of the 1%, they can effectively black out stories from hitting the headlines. At NewsBud, we will report the stories that the mainstream media is being paid not to talk about.
This is a one-of-a-kind chance right now, an opportunity to really be involved in the alternative media and to really make a true impact within this media sphere. And everyone involved in this project, from Sybelle Edmonds to Peter B. Collins, Bill Conroy, Pepe Escobar, Tom Secker, Christoph Gehrman, the list goes on. These are real people doing real, actual, important reporting out there.
The only way to achieve this is to have a 100% publicly funded media outlet. And that's exactly what we are going to be about. Meaning there is no loyalty to the billionaire dynasty families. There will be no loyalties to the mega corporations and their advertisement, because we are going to be 100% advertisement free.
With your support, we can deliver the kind of reporting that is sorely missing in America at a time when it's needed more than ever. We're asking for your financial support of our Kickstarter campaign and for your endorsement of our NewsBud plan to your friends and contacts. Let's change the media in 2016 with NewsBud, the true alternative to compromised media.
Together, we can reach that kind of a media that we are talking about, empowering media.
I'm very excited about this project. It's something we desperately need, and hopefully we can make the controlled and prostitute media obsolete as more and more people get the truth and see just how much they're being lied to. So to learn more about these efforts, please check out their website at newsbud.com. And speaking of independent media, I want to highly recommend the website globalresearch.ca out of Canada. It has postings from a lot of different websites and people, but it's one of the best sources for really understanding what's going on in the world today, with multiple articles on any given topic. In fact, if you're concerned about the Zika virus, you'll be surprised at what you see there that really varies from what you're hearing in the controlled prostitute media. And I'm going to read just part of a long article that appeared on February 2nd, 2016 on globalresearch.ca. And it's by Geroid O'Colmain, who I discovered this past November, and he's just an excellent journalist out of Europe. And the title of his article is Imperialism's Migration Agenda: Who's Funding the Refugees' Transport to Europe? And here goes. Austrian intelligence officials have reportedly revealed that U.S. government agencies are paying for the transport of migrants to Europe. On August 5, 2015, Austrian magazine InfoDirect reported, quote, "It has come to our knowledge that U.S. organizations are paying for the boats taking thousands of refugees to Europe. U.S. organizations have created a co-financing scheme which provides for a considerable portion of the transportation costs. Not every refugee from North Africa has 11,000 euro cash. Nobody is asking where is the money coming from." French government officials have also been caught selling lifeboats to refugees in Turkey. France's France 2 television station filmed French honorary proconsul François Olcay in Turkey. When the official was asked if she was aware that her actions were illegal, she indicated that there were hundreds of Turkish officials involved. Many of the refugees, migrants arriving in Europe, are being provided with false Syrian passports. Until the violence in Syria in 2011, Syrian passports were printed by French government printers. This fact strongly suggests French government involvement in the distribution of false Syrian passports. European governments are outsourcing the management of the migrant crisis to private companies. The aforementioned KTV has also revealed that private multinational project management companies, such as ORS Services, have been making millions of euros from the plight of refugees. In 2014, ORS Services received 21 million euros from the German government and has seen profits doubling since the refugee crisis. The Austrian newspaper Hoyt reported that ORS made 21 million euros this year alone from the migrant crisis. Shareholder finance of ORS Services is managed by the private equity firm Equistone Partners Europe, an affiliate of the Rothschild-owned Barclays Bank, which is considered to be the most influential financial institution in the world. German economist Wolfgang Frieselben has described Barclays Bank as Rothschild's slaughter ship. Barclays is the most important shareholder of both N.M. Rothschild Bank and Lazard Brothers. Former director of Barclays, Marcus Aegeus, is married to the daughter of Edmund de Rothschild. Aegeus was also director of the British Broadcasting Corporation Executive Board and served in the steering committee of the secretive Bilderberg Group. And that's as much as I'll read of that, but it goes on to talk about how the migration crisis is also a plan to destabilize Europe. I encourage you to check the article out. And again, it's called Imperialism's Migration Agenda: Who is Funding the Refugees' Transport into Europe? By Geroid O'Colmain. Now, we in the 9/11 Truth Movement talk about the deep state, the people and organizations really calling the shots. You just heard one of them mentioned, and that was the Bilderberg Group. Another one is the Trilateral Commission, and then there's also the Council on Foreign Relations. Before I began studying and researching about 9/11, I thought that people talking about these three groups were, you know, kind of crazy. because I never heard about any of this in the controlled media. But now I get it. And here's an interesting clip of Hillary Clinton revealing who her puppet master is. She's speaking at the Council on Foreign Relations. And here she is.
Oh, thank you very much, Richard. And I am delighted to be here in these new headquarters. I have been often to, the mothership in New York City. But it's good to have an outpost of the council right here down the street from the State Department. We get a lot of advice from the council, so this will mean I won't have as far to go to be told what we should be doing and how we should think about the future. I mean, Richard just gave what could be described as a mini version of my remarks in talking about the issues that confront us. But I look out at this audience filled with not only many friends and colleagues, but people who have served in prior administrations. And so there is never a time when the inbox is not full. Shortly before I started at the State Department, a former Secretary of State called me with this advice: don't try to do too much. And it seemed like a wise admonition if only it were possible. But the international agenda today is unforgiving. Two wars, conflict in the Middle East, ongoing threats of violent extremism and nuclear proliferation, global recession, climate change, hunger and disease, and a widening gap between the rich and the poor. All of these challenges affect America's security and prosperity, and they all threaten global stability and progress. But they are not reason to despair about the future. The same forces that compound our problems, economic interdependence, open borders, and the speedy movement of information, capital, goods, services, and people, are also part of the solution. And with more states facing common challenges, we have the chance and a profound responsibility to exercise American leadership to solve problems in concert with others. That is the heart of America's mission in the world today. Now, some see the rise of other nations and our economic troubles here at home as signs that American power has waned. Others simply don't trust us to lead. They view America as an unaccountable power, too quick to impose its will at the expense of their interests and our principles. But they are wrong. The question is not whether our nation can or should lead, but how it will lead in the 21st century. Rigid ideologies and old formulas don't apply. We need a new mindset about how America will use its power to safeguard our nation, expand shared prosperity, and help more people in more places live up to their God-given potential.
Her ending there leaves me speechless, considering her role in the total destruction of Libya. So I'm going to close the show today by bringing the focus back to 9/11. The evil powers that be have had their agendas for power and profit long before 9/11, but 9/11 gave them the leverage, the ability to exploit the global war on terror to really move their evil agenda forward. They can now destabilize every country in the world by introducing their terrorists, currently ISIS, into any country they want. And they have the ability to convince Western civilization that they're fighting these terrorists rather than creating and using them for their own evil agenda. They can only do this because they own or control the media. Knowledge about why, how, who pulled off 9/11 and then was able to cover it up is the only way to truly understand what's happening in the world today. The depth of the deception is truly astounding. So if you haven't already done some research around what really happened on 9/11, I really encourage you to do so. Otherwise, you are just in the wrong ballpark. The whole game is very different than you think and that you're being told. To help you out with that research, in the next few weeks, I'll be providing a list of resources on the WWUH.org website. And this concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Kwame Anthony Appiah speaks on his newest book, Lines of Descent, W.E.B. Du Bois and the Emergence of Identity. Well, I'm sitting here surrounded by a number of books. I dragged a whole bunch of them in W.E.B. Du Bois on the importance of Africa in world history. It's actually an extraordinary pamphlet that I got back in 1978. And then John Brown by W.E.B. Du Bois. You know, how many people even remember that? Among other things, he did this extraordinary work on John Brown. And then truly one of my favorite and most instructive books of all time, really, if I were trapped on the proverbial desert island, I would definitely have to have Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880. And with that, Kwame Anthony Appiah is a British-born Ghanaian-American philosopher, a cultural theorist and novelist whose interests include political and moral theory, the philosophy of language and mind, and African intellectual history. And we're privileged to have Professor Appiah with us to discuss his latest book, Lines of Descent, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the Emergence of Identity. And thank you for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
Now, I have to say, it's hard for me to even figure out where to start, because as I said, I've got all these books in front of me, and I have to say that for me, and I'm most interested in your theories on this, that in Black Reconstruction, I really saw a coming together, a kind of melding of a convergence and understanding of the relationship between race and class brought to us by W.E.B. Du Bois. And one of the pieces from Black Reconstruction that I particularly remember was when he was talking about the role of whites and white overseers during the periods of slavery. And just to read from a sentence or two and then your thoughts. He said, first, they constituted the police patrol, who could ride with planters and now and then exercise unlimited force upon recalcitrant or runaway slaves. And then, too, there was always a chance, that they themselves might become planters by saving money, by investment, by the power of good luck. And the only heaven that attracted them was the life of the great Southern planter. So the aspiration of the overseer, of the white worker to the planter class, carried with it a systemic sense of the nature of slavery in this country, which, of course, there is a moral issue relevant to, but there was a systemic basis for. And it seemed to me that in terms of identity, that Du Bois got it right and began to bring this important convergence together for us. Your own thoughts on the whole issue of W.E.B. Du Bois and his conceptual framework and what race meant to him.
Well, I think that Black Reconstruction, which is a work of, you know, when he was, it's from 1935, I think, or so. So it's one of his later works. And it's at the point in his life when he has really, taken on board a very much a class understanding that is, however, very different from the understanding of the United States that was dominant among sort of communists, because he saw that race and class were not but independent vectors, as it were. They both were important in understanding and analyzing the society that had been left behind by slavery and emancipation. And so he saw that the ways in which the white working class interests were complexly related to the interests of black workers. And, of course, his analysis of that question helps us to understand his view about what was going on in his own day, which was that racial divisions are being used essentially to pit white workers against black, and therefore to allow industrial capital and to keep down white wages, basically, with the threat of black labor. So he had a sense that because of that, that while it was in the interest of capital to keep blacks and whites divided, that meant that you couldn't speak of a simple class interest. You couldn't say that the interests of black workers and white workers were aligned as just workers' interests, because race was playing this independent role in keeping them divided. So I think that, as I say, we have to remember that this is a man who, after his education in the United States at Fisk and at Harvard, had studied in Berlin in the late 19th century, at a time when these socialist ideas were very central to academic debate. His teachers were not Marxists; they were social democrats. But like the Marxists, they saw that class was a crucial issue in trying to understand what they called the social question, which is the question of how to bring the advantages of modern life to working people.
I'm interested in if you could speak more to the development and the evolution of the thinking of Du Bois. You mentioned his study in Germany. The impact of left ideas and Marxism, it's kind of a remarkable convergence of Pan-Africanist sensitivities, of Marxist ideology, can I say Marxist ideology,
yes.
Socialist sensitivities.
Right.
There are those who on the left have criticized him for, quote-unquote, being elitist, relevant to his sensitivities that education was a pivotal force in the development mm-hmm. of the black workers. And there are those, on the other hand, in the right, who give us that picture of that kind, that evolution of his thinkers, and a person who I think was really one of the most extraordinary intellectual figures in the history of the United States, and the dimensions of activism, et cetera, are just extraordinary.
It is. And I think it's important to say that, in a way, precisely because mainstream Marxism really, I would have said, he thought anyway, subordinated the race question to the class question, whereas he really did his whole life think that you couldn't reduce the race question to a class question, that it was a separate issue and that it had its own importance and so on. I think precisely for that reason, we can't say that Du Bois was exactly a Marxist. It's true that he did join the Communist Party, but only very, very late in life. He was over 90 when he joined the Communist Party, and he wasn't living in the United States by then. So I think, on the other hand, as I say, he was educated in an atmosphere of analysis in which Marxist thinking was very central, and he did certainly strongly appreciate the role of class and the role. He always saw the background of capitalism and its connection to racism as one of the central analytical ideas for thinking about society, and that meant that he was always sympathetic to issues about the interests of working people everywhere. I think the role of the sort of accusation of elitism is, I think that's complicated, partly because I think that many contemporary people are confused about what might be wrong with elitism. Du Bois thought, and in this he was not much different from many Marxists, he thought that there was a role to be played by an intellectual leadership in the emancipation of black people and in the move towards socialism, towards a society that was organized in the interests not of capital but of the vast majority of working people. So he did. So I think that's the sort of agenda. And when he talks, as he did, about what he called the talented tenth, the idea that one in ten black, he often said men, but I suppose he should have said people, should get the kind of high-level scholarly intellectual education that he himself had the privilege of having, and that those people, those highly educated people, people who would come out of what we now call the HBCUs, the black colleges, that they would lead society towards the emancipation of black people, that it would be a movement in which the talented tenth played a role both in as a vanguard, as the people who organized and articulated the interests of black people. And I think also, especially in his earlier life, he was very much motivated by the thought that you could combat racism, essentially, with truth, and that educated black people could say to the racist, look, what you say about black people in order, when you're trying to justify your oppression of black people, what you say is just not true. And that's where the historical work comes in, the work on Africa and world history, is pointing out, not just to black people, but to white people, to all people, that Africa is a continent of massive historical achievement, that when the ancestors of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were wandering around in paint and animal skins, Africans were building pyramids and developing great agricultural civilization and developing language. Developing written language, writing, and a great religion. So now I think that in his later years, Du Bois became in a way more Marxist in the sense that he thought that that it wasn't really about the truth, that the problem with racism was that it was in the interests of certain people, and that therefore telling them the truth about black people, that black people had enormous capacities, achievements, great contribution to make to world civilization, telling them that wouldn't help until you recognized the role that racism was playing in advancing the interests of certain people. And this takes us back to Reconstruction, because it, It's the interests of capitalism that are advanced by keeping black and white workers divided. And, of course, there is a real stake for the white working class, even if they're being exploited by capital on a sort of Marxian analysis. Even if they're being exploited by capital, they are gaining the rewards of the system of racial inequality. They're gaining a kind of, as white people, and there's a kind of implicit bargain there that we'll give every white person superior status to every black person, but in return, in essence, you're going to have to accept the economic inequality that keeps the white working class in its place as it keeps black people down as well.
The multidimensional intellectual and activist character of Du Bois is really quite extraordinary. I'm going back and thinking about some of the empirical work in his work, such as The Souls of Black Folk and what he brought to us, and his plays. And then, of course, he edited the Crisis, and he was tried during the McCarthy period. And he was one of the founders of the Pan-Africanist movement. So as much as our time permits, take us through some of that incredible diversity and dimension and depth of this extraordinary theoretician, activist, W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yes, I think, he was involved in some of the major political movements of his time. He was involved in the Niagara Movement. He was one of the founders, therefore, in part of the NAACP. He was involved in the first Pan-African Congress, which perhaps symbolically occurred in 1900 at the beginning of the new century. It was he who coined the phrase, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, which was both an analytical claim but also a kind of call to arms to black people everywhere, and I mean in Africa and actually not just in Africa and in the New World, not just in the African diaspora, but to people of color everywhere to rise up against racial oppression. So, and in saying that the problem of the 20th century was the problem of the color line, he meant that people, one of the things he meant was that people needed to get together in the whole world to rise up against the harm done to people of color by capitalism, by colonialism, by imperialism. And he, as I say, in recognizing that challenge, he got involved in the creation of these institutions, the Pan-African Movement, which, as I say, had its first meeting in 1900, and Du Bois was there, continued, and in 1945, at the end of the... Well, I should say he was involved at the end of the First World War in making an appeal in the name of black people at the end of the war, when the world was being, as it were, reconsidered after that war by the Europeans and the Americans. He made an appeal against colonialism to say, look, democracy has to be extended to everybody. It's not just a thing that's privileged for Europeans and white people in North America. But at the end of the Second World War, in 1945, he was present in Manchester at the post-war 1945 Manchester Pan-African Congress in England, which was really where the agenda of black liberation in Africa was set. It was where people like Kwame Nkrumah, who was going to be the first president, prime minister and president of Ghana, and other black leaders from all over the continent were, if they weren't there, they were energized by the discussion there. And so he was involved in that movement, which took off and was instrumental in the liberation of Africa, in the decolonization of Africa, and in the creation first of the African, what eventually became the African Union, which is the most important organization of African states. Until today, and he's part of that history, and it's in part because he was so crucial in that history that all these black leaders in Africa knew about him, and so when at the turn of the 1960s, he left the United States angry at the persistence of racism and essentially very very pessimistic, I think, about the future of race relations in the United States. He went to Ghana. President Nkrumah gave him a home and support for his work on the Africana Encyclopedia. In fact, renounced his American citizenship, and so this great African American becomes a citizen of this dynamic independent African country, which was exercising leadership again, not just in Africa, but in the whole of what came to be called the Third World. And I think one of the key things to grasp about Du Bois is that because he saw racism as this great global force, he always connected the struggle against Jim Crow and racial inequality in the United States to the global struggle, first against colonialism and then with the independence of places like India, against the persistence of inequality in the world that he associated, especially in his later years, with the role of capitalism in keeping people down.
And as we complete this section, as much as I hate to, but people are just going to have to read Lines of Dissent, W.E.B. Du Bois and the Emergence of Identity, Harvard University Press. It's a brilliant, brilliant, important work, as is The Great Thinker, Activist, Theoretician, Activist, W.E.B. Du Bois. The legacy, what do we learn today? What do we pick up and insert into the annals of Black Life Matters?
I think that for me, and that's why the theme of the book that you just very kindly praised, for me, the Du Bois is really the first intellectual, I think, to grasp, perhaps not completely clearly, but to grasp the idea that because race is not a biological thing. It's not something made by nature or God. It's something that's made through social processes. It's what we would now call socially constructed. The struggle against racism is in part a struggle against the very idea of race. It's a struggle not just against the inferiorization, the attempt to dominate and subordinate black people. It's against against theories that see black people as naturally in their place, as naturally inferior, as naturally to be dominated, as naturally below white people and to some extent yellow people in the sort of standard configuration. So I think, and that meant that he did not think that racism was inevitable. He did not think that, and he also meant that he thought that you needed alliances between black people and non-black people in order to move ahead. And I would say that there's a little bit of a tension in Du Bois's thought, because on the one hand he sees that the intellectual foundations of racism and the theory of race that was developed in the West in the aftermath of the slavery and the slave trade, that he sees that theory is profoundly mistaken, that it's not true that black people are either a sort of biological group that's naturally inferior. He sees that that's true. And the logic of that, in the end, is to move away from racial thinking. And on the other hand, so that's one side of Du Bois, but on the other hand, he's a race man all through his life. He wakes up every morning and thinks, okay, what is this Negro going to do today? he's always thinking of himself part of the time as a black person, and so I think there's a bit of a tension. So, and I think that tension plays itself out today. We have to, on the one hand, Black Lives Matter is about organizing people who are socially constructed as black to resist the continuing oppression of the American racial system and American racism. And on the other hand, it's sort of far future view which is that we should get beyond race thinking. So we're organizing in racial terms in a way in order to move beyond race thinking, and that produces a kind of tension, which I think Du Bois felt and anticipated, and I think never quite resolved, and I don't know that I know how to resolve it either. But I think that that's one of the lessons. It may seem like a rather abstract lesson, but I think that from the point of view of analysis, it's really crucial to see that there's this tension between wanting to see black people, as he did certainly in The Souls of Black Folk, as kind of having a special role in world history, that the history of the world is the history of races for Du Bois in his early work, sort of moving eventually beyond that to the view that, well, if we get things right in the end, this race identity, which is so important to him, that governs his life, that shapes his every waking thought, is going to be transcended, and we're going to move into a post-racial world. And I think that tension between organizing as black people to resist racism and recognizing that race is itself, in a way, one of the traps, that tension is very much present today, I think.
And we're going to have to continue this discussion, and the best way to prepare for it is to read this really important work by a brilliant scholar, activist himself, Kwame Anthony Appiah, Lines of Descent, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the Emergence of Identity. I encourage you strongly to read through it, and thank you so much for joining us and raising these questions and continuing the information process.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Being trans does not mean you need to give up on your life, or your friends, or your family, or your career, or your achievements. I'm going to continue doing exactly what I was doing before, and I'm going to be fucking awesome.
He's written all this horrible stuff about reprehensible homosexual conduct, Lawrence v. Texas. So a gay student stands up in the auditorium and says, Justice Scalia, do you sodomize your wife? And the whole place goes,
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Indonesia's homophobic moral panic escalates, Australia's marriage ban crosses Jordan's awesome axis, and the life and crimes of Justice Antonin Scalia. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending February 20th, 2016. A campaign against LGBT people sharply escalated this week in Indonesia. The leadership of the country's top Muslim organizations called for the criminalization of private, consensual, adult, same-gender lovemaking. Indonesia is the world's fourth most populous country, and it's most predominantly Muslim. Ma'ruf Amin heads an umbrella organization of Islamic groups. He told a February 17th press conference in Jakarta that, "We support the prosecution of those involved in LGBT activities and other deviant types of sexual intercourse, as well as parties that support, encourage, or finance LGBT activities in Indonesia." LGBT issues became the center of national controversy in January when the government minister responsible for higher education, Mohammad Nasir, was widely reported to have said that out LGBT students should not be allowed at Indonesia's universities because their presence would conflict with the country's standards of values and morals.
The country's vice president, Jusuf Kalla, then called on the United Nations Development Program to stop funding its LGBT rights work in the country. Indonesian broadcasting regulators have banned programming that portrays LGBT people as normal. Provocatively conflating two issues, lawmaker Nasir Jamil told local media this week that if the government can block sites that are suspected of terrorism, I think the government should think about doing the same thing related to sites that propagandize about LGBT.
Following up on last week's ban on LGBT emoticons, the Communications and Information Ministry announced on February 17th that it would ban Tumblr until that social media site agrees to block pornography and LGBT content from being accessed in Indonesia. It quickly withdrew that threat, however, perhaps because Indonesia's president Joko Widodo is on a tour of America's Silicon Valley. Islamic vigilantes in at least one city have reportedly invaded boarding houses thought to have LGBT residents. Veteran activist Dede Oetomo of Gaya Nusantara, Indonesia's oldest LGBT rights organization, told reporters that this is the first time it's gone on this long. It's just been one thing after another. It's a moral panic.
Elsewhere, Italy's civil unions bill has stalled once again. Senate lawmakers delayed a vote this week on legislation to finally open civil unions to same-gender couples and give them the right to adopt their partner's biological children. Tens of thousands of Italians have hit the streets in recent weeks for rallies both in favor of and against the proposal. Italy is the only major country in Europe without some form of legal recognition for same-gender couples.
Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has repeatedly promised to sign a civil unions measure into law. But ongoing divisions within his own Democratic Party-led coalition government and strong opposition by the politically powerful Roman Catholic Church continue to be apparently insurmountable obstacles. Church officials are most opposed to the adoptions provision, which they charge will lead to the legalization of surrogacy, which is currently outlawed in the country.
Observers predict that debate on the bill might resume near the end of February at the very earliest. Some believe that the adoptions provision will be cut in order to get the Basic Civil Unions Bill passed. If it makes it through the Senate, the proposal should have an easier time in the lower house, they say, where Renzi's party has a much larger majority.
Proponents of the legal recognition of same-gender couples in Japan had reason to celebrate this week. The country's electronics giant Panasonic announced that it would amend its employee rules in April to extend certain spousal benefits to the partners of its gay and lesbian employees. The company will also strengthen its internal policies that prohibit bias against LGBT workers. Same-gender couples are not recognized nationally in any way in Japan, but two wards in Tokyo and one in the city of Inga have created civil registries for them, and another in the city of Takarazuka is expected to soon follow suit. The registries are essentially symbolic, although they do offer hospital visitation and apartment leasing rights, but only within the municipalities that issue them. Panasonic employees themselves reportedly pushed for the changes. The company, perhaps not coincidentally, is also a major sponsor of the International Olympic Committee. The IOC charter calls for the prohibition of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and expects all sponsors to live up to those ideals. Tokyo will be hosting the Olympics in 2020.
IBM Japan previously announced that it would recognize same-gender couples, while the country's leading mobile phone provider is also planning to offer its partnered lesbian and gay workers limited spousal benefits. This week's announcement by Panasonic, which employs more than 250,000 people, is expected to encourage other corporate executives in Japan to examine their own policies.
Meanwhile, lawmakers in the U.S. states of Georgia and Mississippi each passed so-called religious freedom bills this week. Mississippi's allows officials to refuse to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. The measure goes far beyond marriage licensing, however. It would also allow medical professionals to refuse services for the same reasons. The bill also applies more generally to foster care agencies, employers, and landlords. It passed by a wide margin in the House and now heads to the Mississippi Senate.
Georgia Senate approved a measure on February 19th, which would allow publicly funded organizations and individuals to deny service to anyone based on sincerely held religious beliefs. After an afternoon of heated debate, 38 senators voted for the proposal and 14 against it. A version of the bill has already passed in the House. The measure now returns to that chamber, where it passed unanimously for final approval. It would then go to Georgia's Republican governor, Robert J. Bentley.
The Virginia House of Delegates approved what is being called a Kim Davis Religious Freedom Bill earlier this week, a bill to protect religious officials from prosecution if they refuse to officiate marriages of same-gender couples, is percolating in the Florida Senate. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, various religious liberty or pastor protection bills are also being considered in 24 other states.
South Dakota already joined other U.S. states to pass a so-called bathroom bill against transgender school students, and a second more sweeping measure seemed headed for passage this week. It would have required all people to use restroom and locker room facilities based on their birth gender. But the bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Jim Bolin, somewhat unexpectedly asked the state house to kill it on February 19th. The issue has been debated enough this session, he said. It had already passed in the chamber's GOP-controlled State Affairs Committee. South Dakota made national news after the state Senate gave final approval earlier this week to legislation that prohibits the use of bathrooms, locker rooms, and shower rooms by transgender students in public schools. It awaits a decision for Republican Governor Dennis Daugaard.
Proponents have successfully used the slogan, "No men in women's bathrooms," warning of predatory male incursions, to attack transgender rights and to defeat transgender-inclusive anti-bias measures. It nevertheless evokes the bizarre image of a bearded transgender man being forced to pee in the women's bathroom, which would certainly be discomforting, at the very least, for the female users. An anti-trans student bathroom bill died in Wisconsin this week. Lawmakers in the states of Washington and Virginia have defeated similar proposals. The ACLU says that other anti-trans bills are being considered in Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, and West Virginia.
In other news, charges of promoting prostitution have been dropped against all six employees of RentBoy.com, which was raided by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security last year. Its longtime CEO, Jeffrey Hurant, however, remains under indictment for promoting prostitution and money laundering. Federal authorities raided the Manhattan headquarters of RentBoy.com in August, calling it an internet brothel that took in more than $10 million in gross income between 2010 and 2015. The site had operated uneventfully for some 20 years. According to the New York Times, the Homeland Security Department apparently became involved because officials believed RentBoy.com promoted prostitution across state and national borders. Hurant has pleaded not guilty, but there are reports that his lawyers are trying to work out a deal with prosecutors. If he's convicted at trial, Hurant faces up to 5 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000.
And finally, Barack Obama has been accused of many things during his political career, including being a foreigner ineligible to hold the presidency, a secret socialist, a secret Muslim, or even a sleeper cell terrorist. But now, a retired schoolteacher who's running for a seat on the Texas State Board of Education is claiming that the president was once a sex worker. Mary Lou Bruner frequently takes to Facebook to blast liberals. The Texas Tribune reports that she only removes posts if she finds out that they're not accurate, for which she apologizes. She once wrote in a since-deleted post that Obama has a soft spot for homosexuals because of the years he spent as a male prostitute in his 20s. She's never apologized for that post, even though she took it down. Bruner rebuffed a Texas Tribune reporter who asked her about it this week, telling him, "You are obviously a hostile and biased reporter pretending to be a friendly reporter to gain my confidence. The interview is over." She's in a very hotly contested three-way Republican race to replace the incumbent school board member in Northeast Texas. Her Facebook page says that Bruner stands for truth in education and not political correctness.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 20th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Hear ye, hear ye. There goes the judge later in the program. Jordan Raskopoulos of the Australian comedy trio Axis of Awesome was clearly not joking with the special announcement released on YouTube February 14th. Partners Lee Nimmo and Benny Davis joined Raskopoulos with their own endorsement at the end of the video entitled, "What Happened to Jordan's Beard?"
So I got rid of my beard in February 2015, and for the past year, a lot of you guys have been talking about it. Some of you want to know why I got rid of it and have been asking when it will be coming back. Some of you have said that without the beard, I no longer look like Jack Black, but instead look like Boo from Orange is the New Black, Russell from Up, and Roz from Monsters, Inc. A lot of Pixar. Well, the truth of the matter is that there is a very good reason for why I got rid of my beard, and a very, very good reason why it is never, ever coming back. And that reason is that I am transgender. No shit. That's right, I'm a girl. I am transgender. I'm a woman, Harry. Gender dysphoria is something I can remember dealing with ever since I was a kid, but I learned early on to be ashamed of it and to keep it a secret. And I did a really, really good job of hiding it from everybody, including myself in a lot of ways. But towards the end of 2014, whilst we are on tour in the UK, I reached a point where I couldn't deny it anymore. And sitting by myself in a hotel room, I decided that if I wanted a shot at a happy life and a happy future, then I needed to transition. I got back from tour in October 2014. I came out to my family, my friends, and Benny and Lee. And then in March, I started the transition process. There is a lot that's changed physically and emotionally in the last year, but I have to say, I am so much happier. Initially, I thought I'd have to give up being a comedian, and that transition and maintaining my life as a performer and singer were mutually exclusive.
But then I started engaging with stories of other trans people in entertainment, like Lana Wachowski and Laura Jane Grace. Then I reached another point where I was like, fuck that. I'm going to carry on doing what I love, and I'm going to enjoy every minute of it. In fact, I think it's really important that I do, because being trans does not mean you need to give up on your life, or your friends, or your family, or your career, or your achievements. I'm going to continue doing exactly what I was doing before, and I'm going to be fucking awesome. So over the last year, Lee and I launched Insert Coin, and I've been writing a number of articles about transgender issues under a pseudonym. I also got to interview and meet Jeffrey Tambor about Transparent. It's a good show. It has my endorsement. My preferred pronouns are she, her, and hers, but I've decided to keep my first name, so I'm still Jordan, though I have new middle names. Also, my vocal range hasn't changed, so when I sing, I'm not going to sound too different. And I have to say that Benny and Lee have been amazing over the last year. They've been instantly accepting and supportive, and I have to say that it is wonderful that I get to work alongside those lovely men. So that's the deal. I don't have a beard anymore because I'm a woman. It's also the reason the YouTube channel was pretty quiet last year.
But now that the news is out, we're going to get things rolling again. Quickity split.
We've got a new album out now, we've got a tour coming up, and we've got loads of music videos and sketches coming out on the YouTube channel very soon.
So the beard's gone. Sorry to all the fans of the beard. I'm not going to answer any personal questions, but if you want to leave a message of support, feel free. But don't be a dickhead. See ya.
She will wear you out. Viva la vida loca, Las Vegas.
Indeed, the vast majority of Axis of Awesome fans have not been
dickhead.
And have been very supportive of the transition of Jordan Nicola Bridget Raskopoulos. However, as she told Channel 10's The Project, Australian law would force Jordan to throw her biggest backer under the bus.
My wife is the most supportive person in the world, and she even helped me edit the video, which was really cool. But, you know, the most difficult thing that we're dealing with now is the same thing that a lot of queer couples are dealing with, which is the issue of marriage equality. For me to legally change my gender on my birth certificate, we have to be divorced. So I can't actually fix my birth certificate unless I'm not married to a woman, because under Australian law, two women can't be married.
That seems really weird, like on lots of levels, but... Why the birth certificate? Like, why is that the one thing that you can't change, but everything else you can and there's no issue?
Yeah, no, there's no problems with my passport, driver's license, anything like that, but the birth certificate's the big one. And it's just another kind of face of the marriage equality issue, I think, because, you know, we are already married and we're happily married and the law kind of wants to bust us up.
As Jordan fights to keep her marriage intact, there's no divorce in store for Axis of Awesome. The new CD, Viva La Vida Loca Las Vegas, has just come out, and the trio will be appearing at Adelaide Fringe and the Melbourne Comedy Festival in the coming weeks.
Hello, I'm Robbie Kaplan, the author of Then Comes Marriage, United States v. Windsor and the Defeat of DOMA. And you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
The accolades abounded as the U.S. Supreme Court's arch-conservative firebrand was memorialized this week. But Gay USA's Andy Hum and Ann Northrup come to bury Justice Antonin Scalia, not to praise him.
The problem is, if you've been watching the news, the big news shows, they are not getting into how awful he was. Oh, what a great thinker, what a fine mind, what a great writer, what a so influential on the court. Of course, he was on the losing side of most of the gay rights cases.
Well, yes, that was heartening. And there were 6-3 decisions, a lot of them, that he was on the losing side of. My favorite moment in the coverage, and I've been watching this nonstop, wall to wall, one guest, Linda Greenhouse, legendary, longtime Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, yes, goes on a show on CNN or MSNBC over the weekend. And this is the only time I've seen her appear, which may be because of what she said, which was, well, you know, really, he wasn't all that influential.
he wasn't interested in forming coalitions or bringing people to his point of view. So he was kind of a lone wolf, and he really didn't have much of an impact on anything.
And whenever he knew he was going to be on the losing side, he really let loose with extremely offensive things, especially about us.
Yes.
I mean, we should, since you're not hearing them on a lot of the other news shows. Oh, yes, they said he was controversial and all those kinds of stuff. But like in the Lawrence v. Texas case, when we finally get rid of the sodomy laws, he has to say many Americans do not want persons who openly engage in homosexual conduct as partners in their businesses, as scoutmasters for their children, as teachers in their schools, or as boarders in their home. These were the kinds of things that he said.
He said it was perfectly understandable and acceptable to have animus against reprehensible homosexual conduct.
Conduct that's reprehensible, including murder or polygamy or cruelty to animals. We were allowed to have animus against that.
Evan Wolfson, formerly of Freedom to Marry, said that he reveled in disparagement and incendiary attacks. Someone else, Jenny Pizer, I think of Lambda, said that he exhibited endless contempt for LGBT people.
And, of course, you're hearing mostly about the politics of this and how are we going to get a replacement for him. As you know, most Republicans have said we're just not going to act on a nomination by President Obama because it's, you know, he's only got a few months to go.
Oh, please. It's all about their politics. But they're playing a very, very dangerous game.
Yeah.
Because if they lose this presidential election and lose some Senate seats, both of which are highly possible, I won't say probable, but possible, they're going to be stuck. They're going to be in worse position. So now the thinking is that they will do the stall. They will, you know, Grassley is saying, okay. We'll
Charles take, Grassley, the head of the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, maybe we'll have hearings or whatever. But they'll stall until November. And then once they see which way the election goes, they will either do a rush lame duck approval of the president's appointment between the November election and the new Senate taking their seats, or they will continue to stall it out if they win the election.
Scalia had been a law professor. No one had looked into the fact that he was a racist dog as a law professor, treating black students in the law school with animus, to use a legal term. That's what's been said about him. And all this stuff about, this universal thing that, people don't get confirmed in the last term of a president, that is total bull, including Oliver Ellsworth, who was President Washington's nominee to be the third Chief Justice and is a direct descendant of Oliver Ellsworth. This was in 1796. The president only had a year to go.
Yep. He was appointed and confirmed in the last year.
He was.
So,
but, Scalia, he always let his religious views guide him completely.
Unbelievable. And was proud of it. Bragged
but
about the
he,
fact.
He was such... Can I use this word, prick? Well, that's what he was. He attacked Sandra Day O'Connor in a Planned Parenthood decision so badly that moved her to the center and to the left on some issues. He was so nasty to her personally.
He was nasty to a lot of them.
Now, some of the, you've read about some of the people being thought of as possible successors. Sri Srinivasan, a judge who was just confirmed 97-0, but as Assistant Solicitor General, he argued the Windsor case for the Obama administration.
Our favor.
And he's a former clerk for Republicans, including Sandra Day O'Connor, and a corporate lawyer who worried labor unions.
They're talking about a lot of different people, and the speculation is, does Obama go with a moderate who would be so inoffensive to both sides that he would be able to really, shame the Republicans into voting for him or her? Or does he go with someone who's more lefty, who just becomes a great, wonderful goal?
Well, it is all about politics now.
Since we don't expect either one of them to be confirmed.
It has been about politics for a long time. I used to urge Democratic senators, yes, look at what these judges stand for. And if you don't agree with them, don't vote for them. That's the advising.
I am discouraged and appalled by the relentless emotional blackmail campaign being put on by the right wing right now to say, how dare you even think of appointing anyone who is a liberal? The whole point of this whole process over more than 200 years has been for whoever is in power to try to shape the court in the value system that they support. If you're wondering, you say, you know, we overturned sodomy, we got marriage, what more could we want? Well, we're going to need some rulings on these religious freedom restoration acts that are passing in all these states. We're going to need rulings on whether the laws against sex discrimination include sexual orientation and gender identity. We're going to challenge the constitutionality of all these anti-trans bills. We need a Supreme Court that is progressive and intelligent and will take this stuff on. Don't fall for this business of, you know, we need someone in the center or we need someone like Scalia. Nonsense. This has always been a battle over these values. Now, I have to say that my favorite moment from Scalia's life came when he was asked to speak at NYU Law School, which shamefully had given him some honor or award or something. So he goes there to speak. And he's written all this horrible stuff about reprehensible homosexual conduct and everything, Lawrence v. Texas. So a gay student stands up in the auditorium and says, Justice Scalia, do you sodomize your wife? And the whole place goes, total freak out. And his the student, a great guy,
on the show.
Talking about this, didn't we?
Yes.
He talks about how, look, Scalia's in favor of invading mine and everyone else's privacy on these issues and condemning us for our private consensual acts. So I thought it was perfectly appropriate to stand up and ask him about his private sexual conduct. And, you know, this guy almost got kicked out of law school.
Yep.
But it what a hero to call him on
in
this
one
stuff.
Of his, in one of his answers to those kinds of questions, Scalia said, well, you know, what about pedophiles? Nobody loves them. You know, don't they need protection? Well,
and
everybody needs protection.
You know.
I am going to now pause after all this and say, folks, yes, we're all focused on the presidential election and everything else. The U.S. Senate elections will be the key to our future now. If we can't get, and I'm just going to say it, it's not a partisan thing, but if there's not a Democratic majority to confirm these judges, all bets are off, and we're going to get a very bad judiciary.
Veteran journalists Andy Hum and Ann Northrup are the hosts of Gay USA. Check out their show at gayusatv.org. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Dyer V and Wenzel Jones contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride. Special thanks to Ann Northrup and Andy Hum from Gay USA. Jordan Sparks performed and Claudio Abbado conducted some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Alicia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 6RTR Perth, West Australia, KUNM Albuquerque, New Mexico, WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a couple of segments on Black history. That's because it's Black History Month, and we'll hear from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, talking about Emmett Till and Jim Crow, Black people lived under a death sentence. Now, this is an excerpt from a talk he gave back in 2003, and it's a video entitled Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. Before that, we're going to be hearing an interview I did with Joshua Bloom about his book, Black Against Empire. This is a book about the history and politics of the Black Panther Party. It's a book he wrote with Waldo Martin, and Black Against Empire is a comprehensive overview and analysis of the history and politics of the Panthers, and it helped reveal the explosive growth of this revolutionary movement of the 1960s and the key role that the BPP, the Black Panther Party, played in that in a way that hasn't been brought out before. And right now, we're marking the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party, and lots is being written about the Panthers. Stanley Nelson has an excellent new movie that's being screened on PBS, so this is a good time to give another listen to this interview with Joshua Bloom. And opening the show up, we're going to be talking about something that's been all over the news. Both scientists and non-scientists are really excited about it, and so am I. On Thursday, February 11th, a worldwide team of scientists announced the first direct observation of gravitational waves. And this is a major scientific achievement. It directly confirms predictions of Einstein's general theory of relativity made 100 years ago and opens up a whole new branch of astronomical investigation, a new window to understanding the entire universe, really. So, you know, you're sitting around, you're saying, what can we talk about? What can we do on the show? And somebody says, hey, what about this universe thing? You say, yeah, they just didn't just pop. They just did it. They made this, there was this discovery. And I was really pleased about that. And I really wanted to understand more of it myself. And so we hooked up with Joshua Smith, who directs the Gravitational Wave Physics and Astronomy Center and is an associate professor of physics at Cal State University Fullerton. And we hooked up with Josh to talk with us about the significance of all this. Josh, welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you very much for having me on.
Good. We're off to a great start. Let's jump in, man, because I got so many questions. You're going to be tired by the time we're done this interview, okay? Why all the excitement about what exactly happened and why all the excitement about gravitational waves? What actually are they? And why are people excited about discovering them?
All right. So I think the excitement starts 100 years ago. Einstein predicted gravitational waves 100 years ago, but he thought they'd be too small for us to ever measure them. If you fast forward, we've improved technology enough in the last 100 years that we now have a chance, and we've actually done it. And then I think the reason they're so exciting is because they give us a completely new way to look at the universe. As you said, they open a new window. We look at the universe every day with light in all its different forms, radio, X-rays, gamma rays, visible light with all different types of telescopes. Well, gravity tells us not about how electrons or charges move, that which light does. It tells us about how masses move. So we can look at things like black holes that don't give off light. And we can look at them through ripples in gravity. And gravitational waves are ripples in gravity that travel at the speed of light.
Hmm. So again, though, the significance of this, what difference does it make that knowing all this make? What difference does it make?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, Einstein's theory of gravity is the most accurate theory that we have for understanding how gravity works, how the orbits work in the solar system. And we couldn't even understand Mercury's orbit accurately until Einstein improved upon the existing theory that Newton had. So Newton said two masses have a force between them that depends on their masses and inversely proportional to the square of their separation. And Einstein said it's more like a curved rubber sheet where a mass will curve that sheet and the amount of curvature you get is proportional to how strong the gravity is, and that keeps the planets in their orbits. So by understanding Einstein's theory better, we can understand gravity better, which is one of the major forces in the universe. The other thing that it gives us is a new way to do astronomy. So that's something that, you know, everyone can partake in. And right now we're using LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, to see black holes from across the universe.
I want to get into that in a minute, but I want to continue along this other line a little bit because, one of the things I keep thinking, and I know it's not just me, but it's like people who don't have, I mean, I'm very interested in science and I know some things about science and I don't consider myself completely ignorant around it or something. And I'm actually very interested in learning about it. But actually trying to get my head around, you know, this whole idea of why these waves are significant. You talked about it. Okay, it's Einstein's theory and it proved that. You know, he talked about this 100 years ago. You know, but how does this all fit together? I mean, how does it, again, it's sort of like we're looking at it and it's important for people to understand how the universe works. But it's sort of to fit in this like thing that was sort of a momentary chirp. To people who were reading the paper, it was a momentary chirp. And it's sort of like, right, you know, well, why are all you guys out there jumping up and down and screaming and having parties?
I think it's because we don't think of it as a momentary chirp. We think of it as maybe that first radio transmission that was ever sent, or the first form of a new type of communication or a new sense for humanity. So this first chirp was signaling that our detectors work well and can sense this type of signal from across, you know, from a billion light years away. But this won't be the last thing that we find. This actually is the first of many things that we'll see using this new type of technology. So I think the reason why we're jumping up and down isn't only because we've shown Einstein's theory to be accurate in this one area, but also because we feel like it's the start of a new way to do this science.
Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, I want to get into that, but I'm building up to it, man. Okay, Josh, because it's, you know, so many questions. It's exactly what you want. You know, when you actually have this kind of something of this magnitude, and you're actually getting people who really want to understand what's happening this site. Now, again, let me ask this again. How do, you know, you talked about Einstein's theory about gravity and all this stuff, but how could you explain to me in a simple way, how do gravitational waves fit into that theory?
Sure. So in Einstein's theory, where he said that kind of mass makes a curvature in space and time, that's Einstein's general theory of relativity. He also has a special theory of relativity that says nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. What that means is, if you move a mass, like let's say that we made the sun disappear, or better, maybe we had two stars rotating around each other. If you were far away from that system, information about the mass that had moved couldn't get to you faster than the speed of light. And so Einstein's theory made it necessary to have some sort of wave, which in this case is very similar to like a ripple on a pond. Imagine you drop a stone into a pond. The stone changes the surface of the water, and the waves ripple out from that. This is very similar, except dropping the stone, instead of that, you'd have something like a star exploding. The waves would ripple out from that at the speed of light and provide information about the change in the curvature of space-time. So it's necessary both for his special theory of relativity and his general theory of relativity to have waves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, why are they so hard to find? People have been searching them for quite some time, right? And it's since Einstein sort of said he predicted them, but then people have been trying to find them and they've been extremely difficult to find, right?
That's right. So in Einstein's original papers, he predicted they'd be hard to find. He had an equation and he said, if you take this equation for the amplitude of gravitational waves and you put in any practical numbers you can think about, the amplitude of gravitational waves will be practically vanishing. But Einstein didn't have in mind systems like two black holes going around each other. Those systems weren't known to him at the time. And also, Einstein didn't know the leaps that technology would take in the meantime. So in the 60s, people started looking for ways to detect gravitational waves. And since then, the sensitivity has improved by orders and orders of magnitude. And a lot of that is pushing technology like lasers and mirrors and vacuum systems and seismic isolation, and also technology from the world, from companies, industry, developing and being put back into science. So us using developments that, you know, were made in industry. And those things come together, the fact that you have these amazing astronomical objects and you have this great new technology to make the most sensitive instruments ever. And they need to sense incredibly tiny waves because the objects that are producing these big waves far away, by the time the waves reach us, they're very, very small. Because they spread out as a sphere from the source.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joshua Smith. And Josh is He directs the Gravitational Wave Physics and Astronomy Center and is an associate professor of physics at California State University in Fullerton. And Josh, you were working on this whole process, right?
That's right. So I have a team of students and professors here at Cal State Fullerton, but I'm also part of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. It has about 1,000 people working on this, and they're all around the world. Mm-hmm. So a number of universities and funded by the National Science Foundation. And yes, I've been working on this for 15 years. Some of my colleagues have spent their lifetime working on this. And so the February 11th announcement was a major day in many of our lives.
Big party, huh?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, now tell me something. I read something that kind of struck me, and it was because it was said just in such plain language, and it was just so straightforward. It said, you know, we were just talking about why they were so hard to find. But there was also something that like a million different things could happen that could screw up the search for that, like just make a blip or cause something that just to disguise it or be out there and not be what you're looking for, that there are a million different ways that this thing could have been missed. That was kind of intriguing to me because you guys fought through on this and you developed the technology to actually fight through on this. But there still was like a noise coming from someplace or something else coming from someplace could have just completely turned things off. And this was sort of something you really had to use a scientific method very deeply and very profoundly in order to actually continue working on it and also to be able to sum up when you have actually made the discovery, right?
Hey, that's a great point. I mean, this event happened in September, and we didn't announce it until February. And one of the primary things we were doing between September and February was vetting the event. And you're right. Locally, there are a lot of disturbances that can couple into the detectors. The detectors can be affected by earthquakes, by even much smaller things, by local, we call it anthropogenic noise, by people walking around and cars driving. But we have a couple of things working in our favor, and this was designed this way so we could make a confident detection. We have two detectors. One is in Livingston, Louisiana, and one is in Hanford, Washington. They're separated by about as far as we could get them, given the land that we needed to purchase. And that means that it's much easier to find coincident signals that aren't local disturbances. It's harder to have things that will couple into such widely separated detectors. And then the second thing that we can do is when we have a signal, we can compare that signal to what we expect for waveforms from the sources calculated with general relativity, with Einstein's theories. So here at Fullerton, we have students and professors that use supercomputers to model what happens when two black holes collide. And they use those waveforms along with the LIGO Scientific Collaboration to match the data that we see. And this particular signal was an excellent match, whereas most of the blips and blops that you talked about, local noise and things like that, are very poor matches. And that gives us a lot of confidence, but we still spent many months making sure that this was real and checking everything that we could.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I was wondering about too, this laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory, you know, and how it found these waves. You're speaking to that to a certain degree now, but it's actually really, it just amazed me because this is something that was brand new, right? I mean, this was when you look at like the various videos of what this thing looks like and how people actually figured out to do this. It's actually not the thing that you, when somebody says, well, we're working with telescopes or we're doing this or we're doing that or we have an observatory and people are looking at it and think about like something almost out of cartoons where you're standing there, you're looking in a telescope and you're looking out into space. But you guys actually designed something that was very particular in terms of finding this kind of thing. And it was something that was brand new, right?
Well, that's right. So it is very particular. Gravitational waves, the way we can measure them is that gravitational waves, when they pass through you, they stretch space-time. So if a gravitational wave passes through the Earth, it stretches it in one direction and squishes it in the other. And we can use that property to make the measurement. So we built detectors that have very long arms, 2.5 miles, 4 kilometer long arms. And what I mean by arms is at each end of those 2.5 mile vacuum tubes, they're like big tunnels, there are mirrors. And in between the mirrors, we shine a laser beam, and it very accurately measures the distance between the mirrors. And we make it an L shape, so like when I said the Earth gets squashed and squished in different directions, one part of the L gets squished and the other gets lengthened, and a little bit of light from the interference of light will come out and we'll measure it at a photodetector. So we use laser light to very accurately measure the distances, and we look for passing waves. And this is called an interferometer, and you're absolutely right. It's not like looking into a telescope. We don't get an image of the system. It's more like we record a waveform from the system. So it's something a little bit more like a microphone. And by recording the waveform with multiple detectors, we can get confidence that it came, you know, that they were coincident at the two detectors within the travel time of gravitational waves. and we can get information in where the sky it came from, but we don't form a picture. We more measure like a sound. It's not a sound. It's a wave. It's a wave form of gravity.
Wow. Now, this LIGO, is, as I understand it, is only working at one third of its potential right now.
Yeah, that's right. And this is, I think, another part of the reason why we're all so excited about this. So I mentioned we thought that this was the first of hopefully many signals. That's part of the reason. When we make LIGO more sensitive, that one third of its sensitivity is talking about the distance that LIGO can see. But looking out into the universe, when you make the distance longer, you're actually expanding the distance along a whole sphere. So you would cube that distance that you're going to make it more sensitive. And we would expect to see 27 times the number of sources if it just gets three times more sensitive in distance.
Wow. That's...
So there are engineers and scientists at the LIGO sites that are working right now to improve the detectors. We've taken the detectors offline. We're going to perform analyses on the remaining data and publish those. But right now, the detectors are being improved further and will hopefully come online in the summer with even better sensitivity and we'll start another run.
All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joshua Smith. He directs the Gravitational Wave Physics and Astronomy Center and is an associate professor of physics at California State University in Fullerton. Let me ask you this, and this is kind of a strange question because it involves some philosophy, too, in terms of epistemological approaches to things. As I read, preparing for this interview, as I read about all this, I kept thinking that there's something here about, you went into this, you guys all had to go into this, and again, it's also related to the scientific method question. You know, you went into this thinking, okay, Einstein had talked about gravitational waves, and, you know, it was a sort of like, okay, it's kind of, you know, we want to prove that these exist, but you weren't going in to prove something. Your approach to the examining the universe wasn't so that we can find this. It was actually, if they exist, we're aiming to find them. If they don't, though, we'll also have to deal with that, because you couldn't approach this as sort of like, well, you know, we know what we're going to find, and we're just doing this to sort of like find what we know we'll already find. You're actually exploring what was going on in a part of the universe that really hadn't been examined in the way that you examined it. And you had to be open to actually whatever it was that you would find, right?
I think that's right. I will say that I think we took a safe bet. Einstein's theory has been right in every way that we've tested it. And in 1993, there was a Nobel Prize awarded to Hulson Taylor, who discovered a system of neutron stars called pulsars that were orbiting around each other. And later work, which led all the way, which is continuing even today, saw that these two neutron stars were behaving as though, by making their orbit, as their orbits went around, their orbit got smaller and smaller, and they behaved as though they were emitting gravitational waves, and it precisely agreed with Einstein's theory. Mm-hmm. So we had very good information that gravitational waves do exist, but nobody had ever set up a detector to catch them. So I think we took a safer bet in that sense. But you're absolutely right that within the error bars of our knowledge, we did not know that we would see black holes. Did not know that we would see them so early. And we were all very excited and pleasantly surprised to see two black holes the size 30 times the mass of the sun orbiting around each other a fraction of the speed of light at a billion light years away. That was an unexpected source, or at least it was on the optimistic end of what we expected. And that we didn't take a safe bet on that astrophysics. And I think we've made out very well, and it looks like nature's been very kind, and we're going to have a lot of interesting things to look at with our gravitational wave detectors.
Yeah, I'll say. I want to follow up with you often, okay? Tell me this, you know, because, again, if you hadn't been able to detect these, that actually would have – I mean, we're going to talk in a minute about what actually happened, what's the result of having discovered this. But if you hadn't been able to detect these gravitational waves – or if they didn't exist, somehow you managed to prove that they didn't exist to a certain extent, that would have thrown a whole hell of a lot of physics and astronomy into question right now, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And a lot of times I've heard my colleagues over the years say, you know, it might be the most interesting result if we don't detect anything. I didn't agree with them. I'm really happy that we started this new field of astronomy. But that's right. So scientists, of course, I think one of the most exciting things in life, and especially in science, is when you find out something that you really don't know, or you find out something that isn't quite right. It's an opportunity to learn more about the universe. And if we had found that some of our theories weren't quite right the hard way by not detecting something, that might have actually been a lead in another direction. I'm really happy that that's not the case, but you're right. And I'm very happy that you know, the National Science Foundation supported this project, and that we've had, you know, so many colleagues around the world that have worked so hard to make it happen.
Yeah, and you know, and there's also a lesson that the people at large can learn about. I mean, in terms of pursuing the truth without fearing what that might be, actually, because whatever you can find that's true, whatever you can understand and find that's true, actually can help you, you know, in a certain sense. And one, just by knowing it, you know, even if it's something that's a terrible truth and you have to go back and, oh my God, Einstein was a crackpot, you know, but you'd have to, you know, you'd have to figure out, you couldn't just give up. You'd actually have to, that would, you know, better that you found that out than never found it out and you were pursuing something that was completely wrong, but instead you found something very different. And I thought that was actually, in terms of epistemology, that was pretty important in terms of the approach that people take, because, you know, science can't be a subjective, it's not a subjective thing. You know, it's not something that what's true and what isn't is based on who's doing the observing. You know, it's got to be actually, it's objective. It's very, and that's very important. I thought that was really something that you guys, you know, you put a lot on the line pursuing this in a certain sense. And actually now you've got this whole other thing that's opened up, and let's talk about that. What actually has opened up? People are talking about, you've mentioned it. There's a whole new, in a certain way, there's a whole new level of science that's been unleashed right now. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so I think the big change that's happened is that recently there's been a rebirth in astronomy where people are looking at astronomy through other channels. It started with light, and then you looked at light in all of the parts of the light spectrum, from gamma rays to radio waves. And you found different things whenever you looked in those different channels. In the past decades, people have started looking at other particles like neutrinos and doing astronomy with other channels. Now, what we've done here is opened up a way to look at the universe with gravity. And you can look at objects that don't give off light, but you can learn about them based on their motion of their masses. Or you can look at objects that do give off light, but you can see a different side of them because you can see what their mass is doing, not necessarily just what their charges are doing like you learn from light. So I think with this first signal, we've seen the first glimpse of that. And as the detectors get more and more sensitive, we'll probe farther out into space and hopefully see different types of sources. And we'll start to be able to do this new style of astronomy based on gravity. And, you know, there are things there that you can learn that you just can't learn from light.
Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a certain point, and maybe I think I'm correct, my understanding is correct in this. There's actually a point where actually you wouldn't be able to investigate the parts of the universe that based on light, because there's no light there, or it's too, you know, muddy or whatever. And this thing of being able to actually go back all the way back, perhaps to the Big Bang, has a lot to do with this whole new way of these gravitational waves providing a view, a way to view all this. That was pretty mind-blowing there.
Yeah, that's right. So cosmologists think, and I'm not a cosmologist, but we have a lot of really smart people that are looking into this. Cosmologists think that in the evolution of the universe, there was a period where the universe was opaque, so light couldn't pass through it. And so that's like a wall on how far back in time we can look with light. Gravitational waves, because they couple, so gravitational waves are so weak and they're so hard for us to measure here on Earth because they couple so weakly to things. Coupling means you have a wave, how much of it can you grab or how much energy can you extract from it? They couple very, very weakly, which means that they pass right through objects. Our detectors on one side of the Earth or the other side of the Earth, there's no shielding from the Earth. Gravitational waves can't be jammed. They pass right through things. And that means they provide an opportunity for us to look back farther in time because of how they pass through things.
Wow.
And so we have a group of people involved in our in the LIGO Scientific Collaboration that are looking at gravitational waves from what we call stochastic sources, from kind of rumbling sources from the time of the early universe, from the Big Bang. And there are also other projects that are going to have sensitivity in other frequency ranges to sort of fill in the gravitational wave spectrum. LISA in space, and also pulsar timing. And those projects will also be looking for what you mentioned, gravitational waves from the very earliest moments of the universe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very cool. One more question. This is more a reaction from you on this. I can't say the person's name, Zsabolcs Márka, a member of the LIGO
yes.
team. And there's a quote from them that says, "Until this moment, we had our eyes in the sky and we couldn't hear the music." And I thought that the poetry of that in relation to what we've been talking about is it's pretty intense. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
It's a beautiful way to put it. And another way that I've heard that actually a person that I was speaking with yesterday said is that humanity has gained another sense through this discovery. I think that's apt. Although we've only seen one event so far. It's a new sense that we have. We use our tools to sense it, but we can now sense the ripples in gravity from faraway objects like black holes. And I think that's really amazing.
Mm-hmm. All right, Joshua Smith, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and keep us in mind as you go along discovering these things, because we'll be back in touch, man, all right?
That would be excellent.
All right, Josh.
I will do that.
All right,
thanks
a lot, man. All right, we've just been talking with Joshua Smith, who's a professor at Cal State Fullerton, and he has been part of a whole international project to find and verify the existence of gravitational waves, something that Einstein predicted a whole hell of a long time ago when he first began to develop his theories. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Joshua Bloom about his book, Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. So stay tuned. Welcome back. Something's in the air. That's how I felt after reading my next guest's book. It reminded me of all that stuff when I actually lived there, lived in that time, and felt, yeah, something is in the air. Revolution's in the air. And joining us now to talk about that period, and in particular, a very important aspect of it, the Black Panther Party, is Joshua Bloom. Joshua is a fellow at the Ralph J. Bunche Center at UCLA and the collection editor of the Black Panther newspaper collection. He's also the co-author with Waldo E. Martin Jr. of a really important new book, Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning.
Sure. Joshua or Josh?
Either way is fine.
Well, save us a little time if I say Josh. Okay.
Yeah, Josh is fine in conversation.
Okay. First, I have to tell you that this book, I mean, I sat down and read this thing in like 3.5 days. I was just – had to force myself to put it down. It is such a powerful book and such a unique book. And one of the things that I really appreciated about it was the fact that, as you say in the introduction, it was done as a political history. That one of the things that you wanted to do was you wanted to actually make a political history of the Panthers, which – well, that's it. I'll ask you why.
Well, you know, the party has had a fair amount of attention. There's been not only memoirs, but people have written different aspects and pieces of the history. But it's really been hard to make sense of what the politics of the party was. And it's sort of a puzzle. I mean, it's always hard to figure out histories. But why, you know, why has there been so much attention, and why for such an organization that was so important and so formative in the late 60s and into the early 70s, why hasn't anyone really, you know, figured out and sat down and really worked through the politics of the party? You know, I think there's a lot of causes and it's complicated, but, you know, a lot of what's been written has really been obfuscation and mystification. And a lot of that comes directly out of the repressive effort to not only attack and repress the party as an organization, but really to obscure and complicate its history.
Well, isn't it part and parcel, maybe even the leading edge of a lot of the attempt to actually rewrite the entire history of the 60s? I mean, it's phenomenal. The kinds of things that are just suddenly reversed. Everything is reversed. Suddenly everything, if you were living there or you were even in that time period and you were honest and you followed what was going on, if you look at a lot of the stories that are told today, the histories, the films, all these things, the idea that people really weren't serious, they were just out for a joyride, that everybody was an opportunist, you get a very different sense in your book. And that's what I really appreciate about it in terms of it taking on the political history of the Black Panther Party, because it's actually something that shows you how these folks developed, why they developed, what was the need for them. And you talk about one thing. You say that what set the BPP apart was that the emergence of the Panthers in many ways marked a break with most of what preceded it in the black movement and in the whole movement overall. Let's talk about that a little, because that's sort of the thing about what set them apart with their politics, which actually did entail a break with a lot of what had gone before it and a lot of other things that were out there at the same time.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you read a book like Hugh Pearson's Shadow of the Panther, which was recognized as one of the most important books of the year by the New York Times in 94, it basically takes the politics out of the party, right? And it looks at sort of what is all the sort of criminal allegations that we can either find or dig up or create, right? A lot of it's not very well substantiated. But this kind of attempt to criminalization was really a key part of, you know, Hoover's thinking, J. Edgar Hoover, very explicitly talking about the real threat of not only the armed self-defense, but the breakfast programs and the service programs, specifically because they reached to broader alliances. So what we were really trying to figure out is, why does the Black Panther Party in a revolutionary politics and a politics that's so distinct from civil rights politics that, you know, you think about the success of the civil rights movement in the early 60s at really dismantling Jim Crow and its claims for participation in America and its turn the other cheek nonviolence and its civil disobedience sort of bodily challenging, but in a very nonviolent, very explicitly nonviolent way, Jim Crow and formal caste subordination. Why at the height of the success of the civil rights movement do you get a real sea change, really, and the emergence in the late 60s of the Black Panther Party really becoming the center of Black freedom struggle and Black insurgent mobilization, where people are saying, you know, no, we don't want to be a part of America. We need to overthrow America. And in fact, we need to be able to govern our own communities. And in part, we're going to have to take up guns and do that through an unarmed revolutionary process. So really trying to make sense of why this distinct politics has become so powerful in the late 60s.
Well, it's really interesting, too, because part of the thing is, you know, when you look at this point that you just alluded to, the point of a lot of the civil rights organizations, the whole movement, was really much more about, we're going to participate in America. We want our full participation in America. And yet what the Panthers came out, and this separated them off not just from the civil rights movement, but also from a lot of the other organizations that were out there and trends that were out there in the world at that time. It set them apart in the sense of, they said, look, we don't accept the legitimacy. The very idea of the legitimacy of the U.S. government and the U.S. system is, no, sorry, we're not going for it. That was a pretty heavy sea change there.
Absolutely. And, you know, you think about the moment and there's really a change that happens leading up to the formation of the Black Panther Party with the call for Black Power. And it really is like this question. And I was surprised when we started going through the archives and even just looking at some of the organizations that Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were working with at Oakland. But same in L.A. If you look at the organizations in L.A. around the Black Congress, or if you look at what was happening in New York or Chicago or other major cities throughout the country with large Black populations, people had seen the civil rights movement. They had seen the power of people standing up to change their circumstances. They'd seen the success of Black freedom struggle, but they hadn't been able to really make inroads into challenging poverty, into challenging ghettoization in the cities. You know, you had had these major growth of Black communities in the North and the West and urbanization. And those jobs that had drawn people in World War II had left with white flight, and the municipalities had responded basically through containment policing. And so, yeah, the Black Panther Party was part of a range of organizations that were asking, how do we build Black power? How do we build political and economic power that really addresses those conditions in the city? And they were not the only ones to sort of take this revolutionary stance. You know, they were in many ways building on organizations like the Revolutionary Action Movement that had taken a very similar anti-imperialist position and said, we need to challenge the imperialist power of the United States and create our own forms of governance. But they took those ideas and made them into a practical politics that was really powerful in a way like nothing else in that period.
I want to talk about that, but first let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Joshua Bloom, who's the co-author of The Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party, and it's put out by the University of California Press, Berkeley. Really remarkable book. I would really suggest everybody get this book, man. It's like you're going to learn so much and, you know, put so much in perspective in a certain way. And I think even the framework for the 60s is people are reminded of what the framework actually was, you know, and that's one of the things I thought was really important. And I want to sort of pursue that line of thought. But starting with the point that you just made, that in early 1968, you make this point repeatedly throughout the book. In early 1968, the Panthers were still a sort of an organization on the block. They were in Oakland. They were small. They had some influence in Oakland. But in a little while, in a matter of months, their membership mushroomed. And in a lot of ways, they were put in a position they never expected to be in. You know, they became the most serious challenge to the whole U.S. empire that ever existed, probably. And the thing is that they had this point you just said about it was partly it was a question of their ideas, but it was more than their ideas. It was what they actually did in the context, in the face of the conditions that they faced, the actual ideas and the implementation of those ideas. Let's talk about that and the difference that that made for people.
Well, you know, you can have an idea about sort of the problems of the state and the problems of imperialism, but that's very different than moving people. And what the Black Panther Party did, there were a number of people asking these questions in different ways, but they figured out ways of actually building the power through disruption by making business as usual impossible. How do you tap that power of disruption? How do you do it in a way that really speaks to people's heart where they're at and can sustain a source of power to build movement? We think of sort of developmental organizing, and there's all kinds of people, you know, all the time who are really going out there and building networks and building organization. And that's really important work. And there was a lot of that in the Black Panther Party as well. But when we look at movements like the civil rights movement or like the revolutionary black nationalism and the Black Panther Party in the late 60s, or you think of industrial unionism in the 1930s, or, you know, you name your movement, the real power for mobilization comes out of tapping the power of disruption. People who don't have necessarily institutionalized power to change things to address their interests within the society as it's established oftentimes are able to really make a change by making business as usual impossible. And the question is, how do you sustain that kind of challenge? And what Huey Newton and Bobby Seale did on a very local level first in Oakland was that they recognized that there was power in the resistance and the frustration and the anger of poor and working class blacks in resistance to police brutality. And they really saw that confrontation of young black people to police as a potential political force. And they were looking at the Watts Rebellion and other rebellions that were going on. And they said, we need to figure out how to tap that. So it wasn't just the idea of revolution and the idea of anti-imperialism and Malcolm X's idea of the black community and self-determination and, you know, we're going to be the stewards of the black community. It was, how do we connect that to what people are really experiencing on the street and how do we build power? And so what they started to do, and they took notes and in some ways copied the Community Alert Patrol down here in L.A. that was built after the Watts Rebellions, they started patrolling the police but doing it with arms. So that instead of having their tape recorders and their cameras snatched and taken away by the police, they were able to actually confront the police in these public environments in front of Merritt College, at the airport in San Francisco, in front of the Ramparts office. They had a series of confrontations with the police in these public spaces where they were armed and they were able to actually back the police down because they were following the law. And they knew the letter of the law and they knew how to act and they knew how to read the situation and were able to actually have these confrontations and stand up to the police. And people saw that on a local level and they were like, wow, this is power. This is something. And so they built a small following. Now, it was still pretty little. I don't know how much detail you want me to go through in these stages. There were a lot of different stages that the party went through where there were changes. The state of California, pretty soon you have hundreds of black people rallying on the streets in Richmond in response to the murder of Denzel Dowell, a young black man, where people are coming to the Panther rally and bringing their own guns, hundreds of people on the street corner and saying, this is our corner. You know, the police don't rule here anymore, right? And all of a sudden, the state of California says, well, we better change the law, right? So they go into the state assembly. Now it's national news. So people have heard about, by February of 68, when the second office opens in LA, people have heard of the Black Panther Party, SNCC, which was certainly one of the leading, but probably the most influential organization mobilizing direct action in the civil rights movement. They're looking for ways to be relevant post-civil rights. And so they're exploring a merger with the Black Panther Party. They've heard about what happened in Sacramento. They've heard about what happened in Richmond. They're trying to figure out how do we build black power. So February 68, an office opens in LA. But what really changes things and sort of puts the Panthers at the center of black politics is the assassination of Martin Luther King. And, you know, young people in these cities throughout the country who have been saying, how do we build black power? And have been looking what the Panthers are doing in Oakland and then in California are like, okay, you know, the nonviolence and claims for participation just are not going to do what it takes. And so very quickly, you have dozens of cities by the end of the year that open up Panther offices with hundreds of members in most of those cities dedicating their lives to the revolution.
Now, Joshua, really important point, because people don't really even get that today. The people were actually dedicating their lives to the revolution that they saw as real. And it was real, you know, and it's in a very important sense. And I think actually one of the things, too, that I wanted to explore, because the Panthers had such a broad impact in society. It's sort of like a living example of the whole idea that when revolution has its day, the people think a whole different way. The influence that the Panthers had broadly, I mean, something I didn't even realize was the influence the Panthers had on the radicalization of the student movement. Really, really important. And not just black students, but white students, all, you know, the whole student movement, the idea that anti-draft activism was actually the way people should be going, that one of the important things people should be taking up. If they're saying they're anti-imperialist, which was one old struggle, then if you are and you want to stand with the people of the world, you have to be against the draft, you know, or otherwise you're complicit in a certain sense. So it was really, really remarkable, the influence the Panthers had in society as a whole and what that did to change the whole climate in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that, you know, there's all this talk about framing and frame alignment and sort of the power of ideas and how you have to talk to the moment. And I think that sometimes there's a way that people get the causal relationship backwards, that ideas are very important, but ideas alone, they need some kind of grounding in real politics to be able to move people. And so you had people talking revolution from, you know, in trying to organize in black communities from, you know, very early in the 60s and, you know, and earlier, of course, but on some significant level with the Revolutionary Action Movement from the early 60s. And it wasn't really moving people. And what happened was that when the party really was able to situate itself really at this juncture where you have broad, moderate black political organizations who organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League even, who while they very much do not support Black Panthers' politics and their revolutionary vision, also are completely frustrated with, you know, the high incarceration rates of young black people, the lack of access to higher education, the lack of employment by the government. You look at fire departments and police departments in predominantly black neighborhoods and cities, and they were all white during that period. Very little incorporation into the democratic local machines, let alone federal representation. Only six congressmen, you know, at the time that the party was starting, only six congressmen nationally, black congressmen, had ever been, you know, sort of elected at one time. So you have a situation where moderate black political organizations aren't getting what they need. At the same time, and this is really crucial, right? The Vietnam War, right, is pretty unpopular already, and people don't understand why they've got to go fight and be drafted and die for this war, right? And yet you look at 1966, right? And as late as 66, there's very little draft resistance. You have these little pockets, right? But it hasn't taken off on the campuses. And it's actually not the Panthers, it's Stokely Carmichael and SNCC that say, hey, if you all want to be relevant, you know, and they're talking to SDS very specifically, and SDS isn't that big at this point. If you want to be relevant, you have to start resisting the draft. And that's where people are really going to listen to you. And what black revolutionary nationalism and anti-imperialism gives to a broader anti-draft movement is it gives some very local, real legitimacy, right? It's one thing to say, oh, we don't want to go fight in this war because we don't want to die. That's traitorous, right? And there were people who were, you know, being jailed and also beaten on the streets, right, for these kinds of positions, certainly, you know, in the Korean War and in World War II, but also in the beginning of the Vietnam War. But what happens is with the black movement moving towards an anti-imperialist position and really the Panthers galvanizing that, this politics becomes a real reference point. And people who are, you know, not wanting to go and fight this war can say, hey, I'm anti-imperialist too, because, you know, you look at the Democrats, right, at that period, 68, right, the Democratic Convention, 80% of Democrats vote to end the war and end the draft, right? But what does the party machine do? It pushes through a pro-war platform and a pro-war candidate.
What?
Right?
The Democrats?
The Democrats, right? The Democratic Party, right? They're not listening to the constituency, right? And so this anti-imperialist position really becomes a way for people to have a political voice. And it's through that practical politics, it's by creating a political position which can draw support, that the ideas shift. Revolution as an idea becomes real because it has power in the street.
Let me ask you this, and this is going, I'm going to combine two questions here. And one of the things your book does an excellent job of detailing the unparalleled repression that the Panthers came up with. And before I get into that, let me remind people again that I'm talking with Joshua Bloom, who is one of the co-authors of Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party from the University of California Press, Berkeley, a really remarkable book, an important book. Make sure you don't miss it, all right? Pick it up and read it. Now, Josh, one of the things that we're going to have to combine these questions, and there's so much to talk about in here. Maybe we'll have you back some other time, but the international reach, all this other stuff that goes on. But you also mention in the book the unparalleled repression of the party. And you say something that I think is extremely important, and it ties into this whole thematic thing that we've had going on here. You say that that repression was not just against the Panthers for its practical thing, but for the promise it held for millions of people about a different kind of future. I think that's extremely important. And in particular, the whole idea of something else you mentioned at the in your conclusion of the book is that while you can't say whether something else would have happened if the Panthers didn't happen, what you can say is that without the Black Panther Party, we would now live in a very different world. Can you talk to both of those things at once?
Yeah. So, I mean, on the first point, right? I mean, Hoover's clear about this, right? I mean, you look at the memos internal to the FBI. And again, it wasn't just Hoover, right? We now have the Watergate tapes and we can, you know, we see Nixon telling, you know, Hoover, you know, and Mitchell that we got to go after the Black Panther Party. But the approach was very clearly we have to vilify this party and we have to drive a wedge between the party and its potential allies. The San Francisco special agent in charge of the FBI said, wrote a memo to Hoover and says, look, we shouldn't be going after the Breakfast for Children program. It has the support of white liberals and the black church and all these points. And Hoover's very clear. He says, look, you're exactly missing the point. That's why we need to go after the program. We need to make this a political impossibility, right? So what – you had a second question. What was your second question?
My second question is the point that you made that the world would be a very different place without the BPP having been around.
Right. You know, and it's hard. It's hard to sort of separate all the very complex historical causalities and really in a precise way say what would have happened. But here are some things that we do know. We know that the draft was repealed and the war rolled back. We know that we got affirmative action programs. We know that we got the growth of black electoral representation, not only on a local level but nationally. We know that there was a vast expansion of the black middle class. We know that many of these institutional responses clearly were not just responses to the Black Panther Party, but they very much were responses to a broad social destabilization in the period. And the Panthers were in many ways at the heart of that. They were not the only organization, but they were a key organization and a key part of a broad challenge to American power and imperialism as constituted. And so, you know, I think we can't really understand where we are today without a draft, with large, you know, it was not during the civil rights movement, you know, that people won affirmative action and access to higher education and electoral representation, right? There's tons of problems that persist. Mm-hmm. There's tons of problems that persist. But there were some real substantive changes that happened in that period.
All right, Josh, and those problems that persist to me, actually because we weren't able to go all the way back then, that's what we really, really need to do now is to seriously take up this whole question of revolution, nothing less, to solve the problems in this society and the world, actually. Joshua, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. All right. And the book is Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. It's from University of California Press, Berkeley. Josh, thank you very much for both an interesting discussion and a really compelling and important book. All right.
Thank you.
Take care now. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back.
So long ago, when a young boy from Chicago town walked through the southern door, this boy's fateful tragedy you should all remember well. The color of his skin was black, and his name was Emmett Till.
Welcome back. That was Emmett Till from somebody named Blind Boy Grunt, who's actually Bob Dylan.
And now we're going to hear from Bob Avakian, or B.A., the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, talking about the era of lynching and Jim Crow and the impact it had on the lives of black people, as well as on the nature of U.S. society as a whole. This is Emmett Till and Jim Crow, Black People Lived Under a Death Sentence. And it's an excerpt from a talk he gave in 2003 entitled Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. You can see a lot more of the clips of the Revolution Talk at the Revolution Talk YouTube channel, or click on the Bob Avakian section at revcom.us for the entire talk and more.
Then there's the story of Emmett Till. Emmett Till was born and grew up in Chicago. In 1955, when he had just turned 14, he went to Mississippi to visit family there. His mother warned and she schooled him about what he would find in Mississippi, what a young black male like himself should expect, what he must do and not do in order to stay alive. And think about the fact that a mother has to school her child that way just when he goes to visit family. But Emmett Till was full of life and full of fun. One day, while in Money, Mississippi, he made the fatal mistake of whistling at a white woman as he was leaving a store owned by her husband. A few days later, the store owner and his brother-in-law came in the middle of the night with guns and took Emmett Till away. They were seen beating him as they drove him away. His relatives began looking for his body along riverbanks and under bridges, where black folks always look when things like this happen, as his uncle put it. Think about that. Think about what it means, where black folks always look when this kind of thing happens. Think about what that tells you about this country. Emmett Till's body was found in a river. He was beaten and shot to death. Beaten so badly he could barely be recognized, even by his mother. A 14-year-old boy, lynched, for what? For whistling at a white woman. In an act of tremendous courage and large-mindedness, his mother, Mamie Till, displayed his body publicly in Chicago, and she refused to have it touched up so that all could see what had been done to him. His body was viewed by tens of thousands of black people in Chicago. The story of what happened to Emmett Till aroused deep anger among black people all over the country. It shocked many white people in many parts of the country, and it became an international news story and outrage. But back in Mississippi, white people rallied to the defense of the men who had kidnapped and brutally murdered Emmett Till. These men were put on trial only because of the outrage around the country and around the world. Death threats and terror against black people in the area where this lynching took place was increased to keep them from saying what they knew and how they felt about this lynching. In a courtroom that was segregated, with white people filling the seats and the few black people who were allowed in forced to stand in the back, the jury of all white men found the murderers of Emmett Till not guilty in an hour. Their lawyers even accused Mamie Till and the NAACP of conspiring to cook up this whole story of a lynching. Actually, Emmett Till was alive in Detroit, these lawyers claimed. Not long after they were acquitted of this crime, the two men sold their story to a national magazine, telling in detail how they brutally murdered Emmett Till. But nothing was ever done to them. Despite a massive campaign calling for the federal government to indict these two men, the government refused. Sound familiar? Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was president of the United States at the time, never even answered a telegram sent to him by Mamie Till. J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, called this brutal lynching of Emmett Till an alleged murder. And he gave much more attention to investigating the involvement of communists in protesting this lynching than he ever did to the lynching itself. But the lynching of Emmett Till became a rallying cry for black people. People stood up who had never stood up before, as Mamie Till put it. In talking about these lynchings, I'm not exaggerating any of this. In fact, I have actually left out some of the most gruesome and disgusting details in talking about these lynchings, because there is only so much of this that you can stand to talk about or to hear about. And these were not the so-called isolated incidents, the way they always try to tell us whenever they get caught in one of their brutalities and murders, the way they try to cover up the real crimes of this system and those who rule it. Thousands of black people were lynched in those times, and all black people lived with a constant terror of this. Listen to the following statement by the author of a book about lynching. He said, "It is doubtful that any black male growing up in the rural South in the period 1900 to 1940 was not traumatized by a fear of being lynched." What is he saying with this? Nothing less than this. No black male growing up in the rural South in that period could be free of that fear. Every black male was haunted and scarred deeply by that fear. Think about what that means. And think about how this touched black people as a whole. A sociologist who studied black life in Mississippi in the 1930s learned how deeply the threat of lynching was in the minds of all black people, from the very young to the very old. And in a PBS program on the system of segregation in the South, which was called the Jim Crow system, they quoted a psychologist who said that every black person living in the South under Jim Crow was living actually under a death sentence. It might or might not actually get carried out, but it was always there. Black people could be killed for anything they did which might offend some white people, and the whites who killed them would never be punished. A black man could be lynched for looking at a white woman in a way that some white people thought was the wrong way, and the whites who killed him, again, would never be punished. Or a grown black man could be killed for not calling a young white boy sir, or for not stepping off the sidewalk to make way for white people, or for any reason, or no reason at all. And this was related to the overall outrages to which black people were subjected. This experience of lynching and its effect on the masses of black people can, in a real sense, be taken as representing and concentrating the experience of black people as a whole, long after literal slavery, with all its horrors, had been ended in the 1860s.
And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of our guests today, Joshua Smith, the scientist from Cal State Fullerton, who was part of the international project to verify Einstein's prediction of the existence of gravitational waves, and they succeeded in doing so. So let's celebrate, all right? I also want to thank Joshua Bloom, who's the co-author of the book Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. And I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my intern, Alex Brenner, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And in honor of Paul Kantner from the Jefferson Airplane, who recently died, we're going to go out with Revolution from Volunteers. Talk to you again next week. Old generation got old generation got soul.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.